Good evening. I will call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Representative Howe, did you have a chance to review the minutes of March 29th?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes.
Very fine. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda this evening is House File 4459. Representative Pepin, Majority Leader Pepin. Welcome to the committee, Majority Leader.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
And I will move House File 4459, and the recommendation is that it be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Pepin, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. I brought this bill forward after myself chairing the Subcommittee on Workplace Safety and Respect. Several folks came forward, members of the public, expert witnesses, employment law attorneys. Our legal staff sat through all of the hearings, took notes, gathered information. We had several meetings over the course of the last couple of months, starting at the very beginning of session. And as you may know, we made some good changes to our internal house policy that took effect after the Rules Committee voted on it yesterday. And we made some really good progress internally. And initially, my intent of starting the subcommittee is to really look at cleaning the house and figuring out what we can do to make the house that we work in a safer and more respectful workplace for legislators, for staff, for lobbyists, for members of the community, for media, all who come here. So that was the original intent of why the subcommittee formed and what we intended to do. But during the process, we had so many folks talk about what's going on in the rest of the world and what's going on in workplaces and other areas throughout the country. And I learned some very discouraging things about what's happening. And the biggest takeaway that I think I got from the experts that came forward was how incredibly difficult it is for someone to come forward with an actionable claim for sexual harassment. I did not know how incredibly high the bar was. And I have a witness here who will probably go over some of the cases. And I don't want to talk about them because they're very, very crude and disturbing. And I think if you have a chance to read them, you would agree with me. And you would agree that you would not want your spouse or your kids or your mother, father, anyone else that you know to go through some of the things that people have gone through, but yet they've had no legal recourse whatsoever. It was very eye-opening, and it became clear that we need to do something. No other state has properly addressed this issue either, and it all stems back to a Supreme Court case 3 decades ago, and times have changed, and I think we need to be a nation leader as well, and we need to look what we can do. So after gathering all the information, it became pretty clear to me that the biggest problem is the court precedent that is the language that says to bring a case to court that can actually survive past summary judgment, the actions have to be severe or pervasive, and that's where the problem lies. It's almost impossible to reach that. And so the intent of the legislation is to say, yes, we need to have standards. We still need to, if someone comes forward and accuses someone else, we have to make sure that that's still proven, that people aren't falsely accused, all those things. But people ought to be able to have their day in court. They ought to be able to, if something has truly happened to them and they've been traumatized, to find out, to go to an attorney and to find out, as many have, that even the disgusting things that have happened to them, even though they happened or they claim to have happened, it's not even enough to bring the case forward because attorneys would advise them, well, does it meet the standards, so you're going to lose. Or they'll go forward, go through discovery maybe, and then it's thrown out on summary judgment. So the goal is not to take the standard from a 10 to a 0. The goal is to say, let's make it a standard where someone can actually get their day in court. They still have to prove that sexual harassment happened. They still have to follow the Human Rights Act, and it has to actually be a legitimate case. It's not a case of, oh, somebody told me a dirty joke, therefore it's sexual harassment, and I'm going to go to civil court and recover a bunch of money. These cases are pretty severe and alarming, and I do have some additional information, but I'm not going to say it on the record in public because it's disturbing. But that's why I'm here today. The sentence is very similar, or very simple. Just simply, the courts do not have to use the severe or pervasive standard when determining whether sexual harassment occurred. And that will, I believe, allow these people to have their day in court. When they feel they've been a victim, they ought to be able to at least make their case and let a court decide, using the language that we already have in law, whether or not that happened. So with that, I'll turn it over to one of the brilliant expert witnesses that we had in committee as well, who I hadn't met before that, but she's agreed to come and testify and share some of the things that we learned in committee.
And unfortunately, I'm going to have to tell you the facts of some of these cases, despite them being crude, because otherwise you can't make a reasoned judgment about where we are versus where we have been and where we should be.
If you could introduce yourself for the tape, that'd be helpful, and then
sure.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Sheila Engelmeyer. I'm an attorney with 32 years of experience, and may I proceed?
Yes, please.
Okay, so let me tell you just a little bit about my background, because I'm different from anybody else that you're going to hear from. I represent both employers and employees. In the next week, I'm going to move to dismiss a case, a sex harassment case, because I don't think it's enough to be sex harassment. Not every bad thing that happens at work should result in money in some plaintiff's pocket. Similarly, two decades ago, I represented an individual who was sexually harassed and who received a substantial award. I believe if my case, the Huffman versus Pepsi-Cola case, were heard today based on the severe pervasive standard, she would have not have survived summary judgment. What I do for employers is not just litigate cases and defend them in court. I go out and I train folks about here's what the law says is okay and not okay in the workplace. I did such training yesterday morning. The other two things you need to know about me is I do lots of mediations. I sit in my office and try to persuade employees who sued employers to settle their differences and talk to each side and try to get it done. I do that 35 to 50 times a year, and I've done more than 100 investigations of a variety of workplace issues as a third-party neutral, looking at the facts to say what happened, hear each side. I am not a professional testifier. I've testified one other time on the 5th of March before the subcommittee where we first met. I did not draft this bill. I did not know Majority Leader Pepin was going to draft this bill. I merely told what I thought to be the truth about where we are and where we've been. Upon reflection, I think the bill is extremely wise in its simplicity. It does nothing more than say the bar that has been set by the federal courts for severe or pervasive is too high, and we, the Minnesota legislature, want it to be lower than that. There are many analogous situations. The Minnesota Human Rights Act has a much lower threshold for what is a disability than what the federal law has on what is a disability. And there's other examples that I'm going to talk about. I do want to address one thing head on right at the beginning. When I read some of the comments in an article that I was quoted in, someone said, well, this is ridiculous. We aren't even going to be able to stand in the same room with a person of the other gender because there's going to be no standard. That is flat-out wrong, and the way you will know that that's flat-out wrong is taking a little journey with me through the history. So in 1955, the Minnesota legislature, with a Democratic governor, signed into law a law that made it illegal to discriminate in a workplace. 1955. For anybody who doesn't know, that's 9 years before the Civil Rights Act passed on a federal level. And at that time, discriminating based on gender was not illegal. Okay, so then what happens? In 64, the Title VII passes, making it illegal to discriminate based on gender, race, religion, all that sort of stuff. And the Title VII did not say it was illegal to discriminate, to harass someone. Okay, there was no definition of the word harassment in Title VII. In the 80s, there's no definition in the federal law legislation of sexual harassment today. That is a material difference between the federal law and the state law. Because what happened in 1980 is a case called Continental Can. And in Continental Can, here are some of the facts. Two women came forward alleging mistreatment. They said that there were three of their coworkers who made explicit sexual derogatory remarks, who made sexual advances, who frequently patted one of them on the butt. They reported it to their employer, Continental Can, who did nothing. Then the coup de grace in that fact pattern is when someone's bending over, Ms. Hawkins is bending over at a steamer. Someone comes up behind her, a male coworker, and grabs her between the legs. She immediately reports it, and nothing happens. So this case goes through to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court at that time does not adopt the federal law. And, oh, by the way, in 1980, there was no case that I'm aware of, and I have been following the federal jurisprudence on sexual harassment intently nationwide for 20 years. There was no case that said anything about severe or pervasive. In 1980, when the Continental Can case came, the court sort of surveyed the federal law and said, we don't really have anything just like this. We don't have anything, any case anywhere where someone's grabbing someone between the legs in their private space. But it should be wrong. It seems like that's sex discrimination. And so the court went about defining what sex harassment was. And guess what happened? Just like the 1955 legislature, in 1982, this legislature took the lead once again and for the first time defined sexual harassment in legislation. That time it wasn't a Democratic governor. That time it was Al Quie. And at that time, as you can see from the bill itself, if you look at the bill itself, it defines what is sex harassment. Now, there's two kinds. Have sex with me and get a good job. That's called quid pro quo. This for that. We're not talking about quid pro quo. Today we're talking about hostile environment, which is Part C. And this is what the legislation that was passed in 1982 says. It says sexual harassment, you can see on line 1.6, includes unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, sexually motivated physical conduct, or other verbal or physical conduct or communication of a sexual nature when, now jump to 3, because that's the one that relates to a hostile environment, when that conduct or communication has the purpose or effect of substantially interfering with an individual's employment and in other areas, public housing, that sort of thing, or creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment or other environment. Okay? That's the standard. There's nothing in that standard about being severe or pervasive. Instead, the standard says it has to substantially interfere. And notably, this standard adopted almost verbatim what the Continental Can Court said in its Supreme Court decision in 1980. So, what happens in the meanwhile? In the meanwhile, the federal courts go along and this concept of severe and pervasive or severe or pervasive comes along. Well, guess what? The first time the Supreme Court of the United States ever adopted the severe or pervasive standard was 1986, 4 years after this legislature had already defined what a hostile environment is without using the phrase severe or pervasive. It's notable that when Bill Clinton is accused of unzipping his pants, pulling out his penis, and asking Paula Jones to kiss it, the Arkansas judge said, no, that's just boorish behavior. It's not severe or pervasive. And that's how the jurisprudence has gone on in the federal courts. I'm just going to give you two examples of what's happened between 1982 and now from the federal courts. One is a 2005 case called LeGrand. In LeGrand, the court assumed the following facts were true. That a manager on 3 separate occasions asked the plaintiff to watch pornographic movies and jerk off with him. This was a man interacting with a man. That same manager told the plaintiff he would move up in the organization if he performed sex acts on him and then grabbed the plaintiff's buttocks, reached for his genitals, and kissed him on the mouth. Then, on another occasion, he grabbed the plaintiff's thigh. The court held, the Eighth Circuit, the leader of the federal courts in our jurisdiction, held that this mere 3 isolated incidents over a 9-month period is not severe or pervasive. Similarly, in another case decided around that time in the mid-2000s, during a 5-week training period in a case called Anderson versus Family Dollar, the Eighth Circuit said that somebody who had her shoulders rubbed, her back rubbed, her hand rubbed, whose chin was cupped, and who was told by her boss, I wish you were here in bed with me in Florida, doing, sipping Mai Tais and kicking up, who called her honey and who called her baby doll. And here's the last fact in the court assumed to be true in that case. The court assumed that it was true that when she complained about her workers' comp injury, he grabbed her by the arm, pulled her back in the storeroom, pushed her once, and in a mean tone said, "Are you going to work with me? Are you going to be nice? Are you going to fit in my group? Now you're telling me your back is hurt? You're nothing but trouble. You're not going to be one of my girls, are you?" The court said, "Well, that's very ungentlemanly, but that is not a hostile work environment because that is not severe or pervasive enough." So guess what happened? I say that's great. If that's how the Eighth Circuit wants to define the law, I personally disagree, but that's their prerogative because there is no definition in Title VII. But what happened? There is a definition in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and what happened is that Eighth Circuit precedent leaked over into the Minnesota state courts. So then we have, by 2010, the case of Geist-Miller versus Mitchell. In Geist-Miller versus Mitchell, Mr. Mitchell's wife, he believed, was having an affair. So he started hitting on someone he worked with. He repeatedly asked her to run away with him. He told her she was his one true love, please run away with me. And when she said no, he said, "You have no guts." Then when someone asked if they were having sex, she says, "God, no." And the next day he comes up and puts his arm around her and says, "Since we're having sex, we might as well go around and go away and have some more sex." He compared women's breasts in a business meeting. He told her her breasts were only so-so. He bragged that he could be out to lunch with hairdressers in 1 minute and sleeping with them in the next. He kissed her on the mouth. And when she asked him why did he do that, he said, "I was having a good day." And then the next time when he bent her neck to attempt to kiss her again, when she pulled away, he said, once again, "No guts." The court held, we apply the federal precedent, and this is not enough to be severe or pervasive. And I could read case after case after case that is very similar. I've written a long article on this subject. It's posted to the Workplace Safety and Respects. You can probably say where the heck it is since I'm not a pro at this. But it outlines kind of what's going on. And occasionally you have a case that goes the other way, but there's way more cases on this side. So this all comes to a head in 2013 in a case called Rasmussen that is before the Minnesota Supreme Court. The lower court, following Geist and all these other kinds of decisions, on these facts, here's the facts of Rasmussen. There's three plaintiffs in Rasmussen, and the alleged bad guy's name was Zapolsky. Zapolsky, the court had to assume, touched the Rasmussen on her posterior several times, twice at least, she said, called her sexual suggestive names, showed her a nude photo from Playboy and said, "This looks just like you, what do you think?" Asked her what her favorite sexual positions were and repeatedly talked with her about his own sexual desires. The second plaintiff had more of the same, but she had one added thing. She had a question from Mitchell, "Can you hook me up with one of your friends? I'm willing to pay." And then the third plaintiff had similar stuff and one added thing that he picked a wood chip off of her chest. I don't exactly know where on her chest it was. But the court, the lower court in this case, said, well, that's not severe pervasive. That's not enough to be harassment. The Court of Appeals took a look at it and saw it a bit differently. But ultimately, the Supreme Court took a look at it. And here's what I find compelling, because you know what? I'm proud of this state for being the first. I'm proud of this state for this not being a partisan issue, because if you look through these cases, there's Republicans and Democrats and people appointed by Jesse Ventura who are asking the leaders of this state to act. So let me talk to you about one such wise jurist who is asking you to act. Paul Anderson, appointed by Arne Carlson to the Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court. In the end of Rasmussen, he writes the following. "When I first became an appellate judge in 1992, I believed that our jurisprudence was irrevocably and steadfastly headed down a one-way path toward ending sex harassment in the workplace. I also believe that the policies of our state and the jurisprudence of our court, when implemented, would ensure that all of the citizens in our state, male or female, rich or poor, young or old, would someday be in a state where sexually harassing conduct would no longer be tolerated in the law. I came to this view based on the cases like Continental Can and legislative acts that followed the 1982 amendment I talked to you about. I was also much encouraged by the attitudinal changes I saw in the workplace. Yet more than two decades later, as my service as an appellate judge draws to a close, I am concerned that the opinion of the majority today renders a significant step backwards. He was worried things weren't headed down the path towards an environment free of sex harassment, and so am I. One other wise jurist, someone appointed by Jesse Ventura, a judge from Hennepin County by the name of Mel Dickstein, wrote an opinion in December of 2017. Here is a case where a manager offered his young female employee to have her come over and get her hair cut at his house, or they could go to her house. When he was fixing a drawer, he said, "You stay sitting right here because I like beautiful women and I like to look at beautiful legs." And when they walked to the vending machine, he said that he would eat her because he likes to eat women. The court found that that was an implicit proposal of oral sex. When they were away from work, he approached her as well at a gas station, asked her where she was going, what she liked to do in her spare time. He repeatedly referred to her as beautiful and sexy. And if you read nothing else, if you don't read my article, please read Mel Dickstein's opinion in Kena versus Homeward Bound. And in that opinion, he goes through all the cases that say nothing is sex harassment. And, I mean, virtually nothing, not literally nothing. And he says, "I have no choice but to conclude that this case has to be kicked out. It's not high enough to meet the very high threshold for severe or pervasive harassment." So, what I understand he is asking you to do, Judge Dickstein, what I understand that Judge Paul Anderson is asking Minnesotans that lead to do, what I understand this lady sitting next to me is asking you to do, is to return to 1982. In 1982, you defined sexual harassment. You defined a hostile work environment just as it's laid out in the statute in front of you. It's not any old dirty joke. It says right in it, it's substantially interfering with work. And we are asking you to make clear that Minnesota's standard is what the legislature said in 1982. It's lesser than what the federal courts now say is enough to be severe or pervasive. Because what has happened is between 1982 and today, this is what was enough to be harassment, and now it's like threading a needle to be enough to be severe or pervasive. A similar analog occurred with respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act. In 1992, I'm sure many of you know that George H.W. Bush signed off on a bill that says, hey, disabled folks shouldn't be prevented to have fair access to work. Disabled people should be allowed reasonable accommodation. And what happened between 1992 and the mid-early 2000s is the exact same thing. The courts took what was disabled. The legislation defined disabled as having a substantial impairment of a major life activity. Okay? Over the next couple of decades, the federal courts decided what was disabled was this small. So ultimately, when George W. was president, he signed off on the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, which says, guess what? We meant what we said in 1992. We meant that disability means somebody with a substantial impairment of a major life activity, and they specifically disavowed all the cases that was narrowing it down to nothing. And you see, the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act is very much like the moment we are in right now, because right now, if you add the sentence that says it need not be severe or pervasive, you aren't changing any of the rest of the landscape. You aren't overturning any cases. All you're saying is the standard is lesser under the Minnesota Human Rights Act than the federal precedent. And as I said in the beginning, the standard is already lesser under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. For example, in the disability context, not only is it, so you know how he said the federal law says you have to have a substantial impairment, the state law says you have to have a material impairment. That's lesser. It's specifically the legislative history makes clear it's designed to be lesser. But that doesn't throw out the rest of the use of looking at the federal law for what an employer's defenses are. You consider the same analytical framework. You just note that the standard of what is disabled is slightly less or materially less. We also know that in Minnesota, the legislature in the disability context has specifically said that an employer has to try reasonable accommodation. It says that a person can, you have to consider whether a person can be accommodated with accommodation, whereas the federal law says with or without. In these important areas where the federal law is different than the state law, the court should be directed to treat it differently. The last thing I want to say is I did training yesterday morning, and I have to tell you, it is extremely difficult to sit in front of these people and say what's okay and what's not okay when you know some court has said it's just fine to say, how about you jerk off with me, or you'll do better when you perform sex acts on me, and there's no case saying that that is specifically illegal. What I do when I'm training and trying to tell folks what's okay and what's not okay, and let's be clear, I'm not doing that because I'm Mrs. Altruistic. I'm doing that because I'm being paid by my employer clients to keep them out of trouble. And I just ignore all these goofy cases. I just focus on the cases around the time of Continental Can. And when somebody raises their hand and says, well, what about Bill Clinton and what he did? Nothing happened to him. Or what about this case I read in the paper where they're asking someone to jerk off? Nothing happened to them. I say, well, you know what? The pendulum will swing back. And I'm asking this committee to begin the pendulum swing back to where it should be, which is a far ways away from what is severe or pervasive according to the federal jurisprudence. That's all I have.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Majority Leader Pepin, for bringing this forward. And, you know, after listening to all the cases that didn't meet the severe and pervasive, do you have a case of maybe something that actually did? I was just curious as to how
agreed. Well, Rasmussen did. Rasmussen, but here, that's interesting, just time out. So what happened in Rasmussen, the lower court said it couldn't be enough. The appellate court said it was enough and would affirmatively rule in favor of the employee, and the Supreme Court was divided. What Justice Anderson wanted was for the Supreme Court to say, of course this is enough. You don't have to go back to a trial to figure out if this is enough. This is enough. But the majority just concluded this is enough to get you a trial.
Can you review which case that was?
Rasmussen.
No, but that details about
it. Oh, do you want me to tell you what Rasmussen was about? Sure. So Rasmussen was the case where one of the plaintiffs was touched on the posterior repeatedly. All the plaintiffs were given sexually suggestive pet names. The employee was shown a nude photo from Playboy and said, doesn't that look just like you? The manager asked her what her favorite sexual positions were and told her what his favorite sexual positions and desires were. Asked underling whether she could hook him up with someone for sex, and he would pay for it, and picked a piece of wood off someone's chest.
Any other questions? One of the kind of questions that have been floating around the Capitol here in the last week or so has been, you know, oh, if we remove the severe and pervasive standard, then it's kind of going to be the wild, wild west. We're not going to have any standards at all. So I'd like just to get on the record what the other standards are for bringing a case for sexual harassment. Ms. Engelmeyer, if you want to.
Yeah, so I guess I have three things to say about that. Number one is it's right in the House bill. Thank you. Sorry, I have too much stuff around here. The standard is what's set forth in subpart 3. does it substantially interfere with an employee's employment? Okay? Does it create an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment environment? Okay? So, you know, would I have added a few more words if I were drafting this? But maybe that's just because I'm, you know, a big word person. There is nothing on the face of this. What I've heard people say and what I've read in the comments to the articles, well, this will mean that you're overturning, for example, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Freeler. In Freeler, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, hey, we, for purposes of supervisor sex harassment, are going to borrow from the federal law and say that if you have supervisor sex harassment that results in tangible employment action, there is no defense for an employer. But if it doesn't result in a really big deal, an employer can win. If the employer shows they took all reasonable steps to prevent and correct, and the employee failed to seek help. There's nothing in this bill that says get rid of Freeler. This bill just says what is enough to meet the first half of the threshold, because you see how harassment works is much like a disability case. The first part of the inquiry is it enough? The second part of the inquiry is the defense. This just addresses is it enough. It does not touch the defense part of the equation.
Thank you. Other member questions? Thank you. We're going to – Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had another quick question. And maybe you don't have the answer, or maybe the majority leader does, but have you done kind of a survey of the cases and how many of them actually survived the summary judgment? You know, I mean, how many actually got their day in court?
Almost very few. Almost. Okay, so two things. What I know is there's research with respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, that analogy that I made for you, that showed that in that window of time when it got real narrow, less than 8% of the people succeeded. I have been watching and writing about, I've written 7 iterations of this article that I have shared with the Subcommittee on Workplace Safety and Respect. And I can tell you that the pendulum has swung in the last 20 years from my case, Sandra Huffman, in 1994. She was called names. She was hoot and howled. They put her hands on inside her clothes. That would not suffice under the cases that I have stated here. And I have not, my own self, done a statistical analysis, but I would challenge any lawyer in this room to tell you truthfully that the window for what is enough to be severe pervasive is anything other than extremely narrow, almost needle narrow.
Madam Chair, just
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your latitude. So as I'm listening to you talk, and, you know, I'm wondering if the severe and pervasive rises, you almost have to rise the level of a sexual assault that would be
there are some sexual assaults that have not been enough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're saying that, a third-degree sexual assault maybe does not rise to the level of severe and pervasive sexual harassment?
Physical matter.
Well, I apologize. I'm talking over you. I'll try to be better.
Right.
You know, let me just cite a couple of cases. So, I mean, I think LeGrand is a good example. This person's testicle was grabbed and butt was grabbed. And I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I don't know chapter and verse what third-degree sexual assault is, but I got to think grabbing a butt and testicle counts. And the court found that was merely 3 incidents in 9 months and not enough to be severe or pervasive.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Right. We're going to move on to our other list of testifiers. Ms. Engelmeyer, if you want to stick around, that would be great. Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Commissioner Kevin Lindsay, and on deck, Lisa Stratton.
I didn't know if you want me to stay or if
you
want
to stay
me.
There. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Madam Chair, I appreciate the question that you asked concerning what would the standard be if severe and pervasive were taken out. And I would suggest to the committee that the answer lies within the decision of Continental Can, which was a Supreme Court decision from 1980. The case site for those that are interested is 297 Northwest 2nd, 2004, or 241 to 249, specifically page 249. And specifically within the court case, the court talks about the totality of the circumstances that would have to be examined. So by removing severe and pervasive, you would not impact totality of the circumstances. Courts would continue to apply that in determining whether sexual harassment occurred. There's also what I thought I heard within the committee discussion, this question of whether it would be subjective, objective standard. And just for clarity, so to the extent that someone feels that they personally have been harassed, that's not sufficient currently under the law to state a cause of action. It's also judged by the objective standard. So to the extent that the average person would not feel harassed, then that would not meet the standard of sexual harassment. So to the extent, again, that you took severe and pervasive out, that standard of subjective and objective would still continue, but the new standard would be a substantial interference with the employment relationship. So there are standards that would apply going forward within this respective area. I think the difficulty for a lot of attorneys or individuals who would come up here and testify concerning, can you give us a slew of cases which would establish the severe and pervasive? I think most of those cases settle as opposed to getting to appeal. And the cases that we have seen settle within this space, they generally have multiple incidences of touching, and typically there is some type of significant sexual overture to the respective touching. But even in those instances where you have multiple incidents of touching and sexual overtures, that does not necessarily mean that you're still going to prevail on severe and pervasive in meeting that standard. And I think that's where courts, people within the community, folks within the legislature question whether severe and pervasive should be the standard, and specifically when we have the state statute which talks about substantial. Because we're not talking about an innocent joke, an innocent flirtation, because that's not going to meet the standard of substantial interference within the employment setting. I think where we are at a time is I think that we want to have a workforce where people can come and do their work without feeling intimidated, without feeling put upon, and that they can do their work. Returning the standard where you have substantial interference, I think, strikes the right balance. Minnesota has always been a leader in this area. 1982, this discussion with Continental Can came 4 years prior to the Supreme Court establishing the standard of sexual harassment under Title VII in a case called Meritor versus Vincent versus Meritor Savings Bank. I think it's time for us again to revisit it. I applaud Representative Pepin, and I applaud other authors to this bill of trying to restore that proper balance between a workplace which is allows everybody to bring their whole self into that workplace and one that seeks to establish and prevent folks from being put upon or being interfered with in the workplace. And if there are any questions concerning the standard, how we would be looking at it, or I could read provisions within the state statute as well, which underline this point. But I think that it is really clear that substantial would still be in the law.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I'm wondering if you could just speak a little bit to the difference between subjectivity and objectivity and how both of those would play into cases moving forward if we did remove this standard of severe and pervasive.
Mr. Lindsay.
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, when we think of subjective and objective, it exists in several areas within the law. most law students first hear about it in tort class. So to the extent that I feel that I have been put upon or I have been embarrassed, but it is not something that the majority of the people in the room or the majority of people would feel, they would be embarrassed. My personal embarrassment, that would be subjective. It would be my own personal one. The objective standard would be by community norms and standards. So to that extent, in this context of sexual harassment, someone could have an interaction between one employee to the next. They may personally be offended by that respective conduct or comments, but if the majority of the community would look at that behavior and not feel that that would rise to substantially interfering, there would be no cause of action for that individual. And attorneys, before they would initiate an action, they wouldn't have to examine both elements. They could not just simply rely on the subjective element.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lindsay, can you speak to at all, and if you can't, don't worry about it because you may have not prepared for this specific line of questioning, but the state Supreme Court habit or state courts, the custom of kind of dragging and dropping the federal standard, a federal standard like they did in this case, that was not contemplated or in any way reflect the intent of this legislature. What's the jurisprudential history of that? How is it authorized by the courts to do that? And is this the best way to fix it?
Commissioner.
Because if we correct the law, what's to stop them from just doing it again and making their own thing up again? And by saying that, Madam Chair and Commissioner Lindsay, every year in the last 10 years, I've brought a piece of legislation to tell the Minnesota Supreme Court that's not what we meant. Every single year I've done that in the last 10 here. I'm kind of tired of doing it, but I've learned after 10 years that it's probably going to keep happening as long as I stay up here. So that's the basis for my question.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Madam Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, I'm reminded of two things which I have heard in conversation with law schools and with law professors. The first is that it's easy to shoot into a barrel of contained fish, and that is because court opinions, because they are offered in so many, is that it's easy sometimes for one or two to get off track. So with 2020 hindsight and looking at it, I would not wish to suggest that the court was asleep at the wheel as it relates to the overall development of the law in this respective area. The second thing I would say is that I'm reminded of is a quote by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and she wrote it in an opinion about 20 years ago, and I think that is still true today, and that is if you stayed up for every minute of every hour of every day of the entire week, you could not read every ordinance, every law that was passed by every city, every state, and the federal Congress. So with those two caveats, let me say this. I do think from time to time, courts seek to try and reconcile state and federal law. And it is conceivable in looking at the substantial language that some courts probably grafted the substantial language to the severe and pervasive standard at the federal law. But the severe and pervasive standard emerged 4 years after the fact of substantial being in state law. So from that vantage point, it would not have been appropriate to really graft that type of interpretation. But I do appreciate the fact that it can be an instance in which courts are trying to reconcile, harmonize state and federal law. So you have, and the members of this committee, have a duty, a responsibility to review court cases from time to time. Representative Pepin and other members that are authoring this bill, I appreciate them stepping into this point to take a hard look to see how the law has developed. And let's come back to the proper standard for the interpretation of sexual harassment in Minnesota, and that is substantial interference in the setting should be sufficient for a sexual harassment claim. That is not one which is going to allow a trivial joke, an appropriate comment, one isolated comment, to rise to that level of sexual harassment.
The other, Representative O'Neill. It's all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so inquisitive. I have so many questions. So I'm trying to wrap my mind around what would happen if we get rid of severe and pervasive. And something that comes to mind is, can you give us some examples of how you would demonstrate and show evidence that this had occurred, more than just his testimony, her testimony, but can you give us some examples of demonstrations of the of evidence that had to be presented in order to prevail with the standard, like you were saying, about the hostile work environment and interfering with work?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, I would think one of the things in which an attorney which was representing an employee in such a setting, that attorney would try to establish that there had been a diminution in the ability of the employee, a loss of the employee to be able to perform their work. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that they had been a stellar employee and they had been turning in their work on time, high quality work, after the inappropriate behavior by the, in this case I'll make it easy, a male employee, by the male employee to the female subordinate, that there are assignments not turned in on time. The quality drops off. And there's always going to be instances in which some inappropriate behavior is going to be done in space and time, such that there won't be a large number of witnesses. But I will say within my experience in this is that if you ask enough questions, typically you do find one or two other individuals within the workplace that can either support the individual who's bringing forth the claim of harassment or support the position of the employer that no harassment occurred. There has to be a little work, a little digging to ferret out the facts, but that can be done.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about, like, text messages, emails, voicemails, that kind of thing? That must be able to help the case.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, you're absolutely right. The 7 years that I have now been commissioner, the sexual harassment cases that we have found probable cause, text messages often are part of the evidence which we review. It is surprising times in which people will send photographs or provocative words through text messages, and that is helpful to discern who is telling the truth concerning inappropriate behavior in the workplace.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Thank you, for Commissioner. Please stick around in case there are questions later unless you want to go home, right? It's only 8:30 tonight, so it's kind of up to you, I guess. But we'd love to have you stick around if there are questions in the future, you know, the rest of the hearing. But
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to stick around. Thank you.
Perfect.
Very much.
Ms. Engelmeyer, before we go to the next testifier, I do have a question, another question for you, if you're willing to step back up to the table. Thank you. In your experience, when someone brings a suit and they get past the summary judgment point, and let's say it's a woman filing a suit against someone that she works with, is it always the individual that's named, or is it sometimes also, like in this Continental Can, obviously it was the employer that was named? And I guess my question really goes to, if the case is against an individual and that person has no ability to have any sort of a payout, right, does the victim then seek damages from the employer, because the employer usually has more wherewithal to come up with the funds?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, there is no individual liability for sexual harassment. So the claim is always against the employer.
Okay.
A claim against an individual would be dismissed. And so, as I said, there are sort of two parts to the to the inquiry of whether one can succeed in a harassment claim against the company. Part one is what is enough to actually be harassment, and part two is whether the employer is liable. And that part turns on whether or not there was prompt remedial action taken once there was a problem. I mean, there are dozens of cases where something really awful, like a rape or sexual assault, happened, but the employer had no reason to know, and they rightfully were held not liable.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Ms. Stratton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Stratton, and I'm an attorney. I have been practicing employment law for 20 years or so, and have represented, unlike Ms. Engelmeyer, I have generally been on one side of cases. I have always represented people who have been victims of harassment, whether it be sexual, racial, or other bases. And in 2010, I started a nonprofit, so I'm testifying here today in that capacity as a nonprofit organization that zeroes in on the causes and consequences of gender inequality specifically. I'm here tonight to tell the members of this committee why we at Gender Justice believe that Representative Pepin's bill, House File 4459, has a great potential to move us forward as a community that wants to end sexual and other forms of bias-based harassment and hostility in our workplaces. I testified previously in front of the subcommittee on workplace respect and safety, and I won't repeat. I testified quite a bit, probably too long, about the best practices in this field that the social science that has developed around in again, 25, 30 years about what causes sexual harassment, what kinds of environments are ripe for sexual harassment, and where the impact is worst. And so I won't go through all of that painstakingly with you, but I will share just the conclusion that I drew at the end after presenting that research, which is that sexual harassment is preventable, and the single most important component of creating safe work environments is demonstrating through both words and action that sexual harassment is not and will not be tolerated. That's what this bill is going to work toward. Having more of our workplaces have actual accountability for the kinds of really horrendous stories that come to us, those of us that hold our doors open for people who feel they've been victimized and hear their stories. And I can't tell you how terrible it is if you have someone come and tell you the kinds of stories with the kinds of facts that Ms. Engelmeyer just shared and others I could share with you, and to have to sort of say, I understand how terrible that was. I can understand how you felt. I am afraid a court would not. And why am I afraid of that? It's that severe, pervasive piece. I am not afraid that I can't convince a court that one of these environments doesn't affect a person's ability to do their work and to be effective. That, as the commissioner suggested, is something that is more provable. You have work performance over time. You have behaviors. You have psychological testimony sometimes. What's not provable is meeting what a judge has decided based on this terrible case law does and doesn't constitute something severe or something pervasive. Courts are often mistakenly applying them both together, which compounds the situation. So I think this bill would help move us forward and end a serious problem, or at least start us there. One of the concerns I've heard expressed is this, as soon as if this bill became law, immediately no one could tell a sexual joke in the workplace, right? This one time, it'll be a disaster. Everyone will be claiming sexual harassment. I cannot, in my wildest dreams, imagine any court jumping from the kind of horrific case law we have right now, where sexual assaults don't even count, to one joke and you have liability. That is not going to happen in any scenario. The case law is still out there, and it does have to have that substantial interference with the person's ability to do their work. So all it would do is untie the hands of our Minnesota judges, who should be applying our Minnesota values and our views that this legislature set out about what constitutes sexual harassment. I just have one other thought that I think I might have a slightly different perspective on than many people who even do exactly what I do, which is one of my sort of niche interests or passions is for women who are working in non-traditional environments, what that's like and what the kinds of harassment happens that is experienced by those women is not as likely to be sexual as purely hostile to their very presence and existence and competence, being in a workplace that has been predominantly male. If you think back to the Eveleth Mines case in Minnesota, I started working in the law firm that had handled that case for a decade for the women that went into the mines. That's the kind of case that I love to do because I think it's so important. We all need to be able to simply exist and do our jobs, right? And I think this severe pervasive standard has a particularly tough impact on those cases because I think it's easier for courts and judges to see severity with serious sexual assault. But the severity of feeling unsafe when you're at a workplace and you're afraid someone might grease the steps up to the crane you operate in a paper mill that's, you know, stories high, and you might die, is a different kind of severe. But often these cases that have a lot of sexual activity are contrasted, and the severe pervasive standard is used to say, so this, you know, you're not being raped, basically. So this stuff that could makes you afraid for your life, makes you feel completely unwelcome where you are and like a second-class citizen in the workplace, it's not that. So I throw that out there just as another consideration because I think it supports the helpful move that this bill presents. So gender justice, we applaud the unique ways that the Me Too movement has created this moment where you all are listening and women and others who are harassed, and I know it is not all just women, are speaking their truth and being heard. And this bill, to me, is so exciting, an example of people having been heard and you all coming up with a solution that takes Minnesota back to where it always was, where you set it out in the first place with the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Stratton, for being here. Next person is Mike Hickey, and on deck, Kurt Erickson. After that, Melissa Raffin. Raffin.
Okay. And Chair Kurt Erickson is going to be joining me.
Okay,
perfect. Probably bring another chair up. Or?
Yeah. Okay. We've got plenty to spare. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, the state's major small business group. I may need some water here, but a major small business group. I'm also speaking on behalf of Minnesota for Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, a group that's appeared in front of this committee many times, and appreciate your support on our initiatives regarding lawsuit reform and lawsuit issues. Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform is a large group of business associations and individual employers, and we have, well, thank you, and we have serious concerns about the bill. But clearly, like many other players in the economy, small business needs to do more to educate employees, to train employees, and to stop terrible actions of harassment in the workplace. And there's some fairly appalling case law here that I think a lot of us are just learning about in the last week since this issue has become put on the radar screen. And so we understand there's a desire to want to change Minnesota law. I think the key challenge for you tonight and for the rest of this session is how we're going to change this law, and we're very concerned about this change. This is a big change, throwing out a long-term precedent that has guided the judiciary, the federal government, and the state government, Meritor Savings Bank versus Vincent since 1986. And so this is a big change, tossing out that decision, Minnesota saying, we're going to go another route on these types of cases and not replacing it with anything real clear to us tonight. And so that is a big concern. We're also very concerned about the impact of what we think or expect to be an increase in lawsuits, some deserved, some not, but on small business. Small businesses are in very vulnerable financial situations. Many of them have very small profit margins. Many of them are not organized to the point where they should be, and they may pay a real penalty for it by not doing enough training, not having a human resources department. But what you need to realize as lawmakers, if you don't know you're going to be around next year, it's really hard to invest in all these things that large corporations can afford to do with human rights departments and a battery of attorneys and the guy who's taken a personal loan, the guy who's taken a second mortgage to try to pursue a dream in commerce. He doesn't know if he's going to be around next year. Small business has very high failure rates. And so, frankly, we are worried, Madam Chair, about if there is a significant increase in suits, and to some degree there should be. But I think there is going to be one way or another if we enact this bill without any changes. What's going to be the impact on small employers and how many are going to be able to take the hit? Many of them don't have the EPLI insurance, the employer practice liability insurance. So those are our concerns, and I wanted to stop now and yield to Mr. Erickson. He's got significant experience as an employment attorney, occasionally on both sides, but he's going to give you, he wants to make some significant comments about this change and share his wealth of knowledge and experience.
Representative Hillstrom, you have a question first before we hear from the other testifier?
I do, if I could.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hickey. I'm glad you're here. This bill, as I read it, has an effective date of August 1st of 2018, so any incidents that happened prior to that date would not be counted under this law change. Do you believe that these small employers would not be able to get that insurance that you speak of that they don't have currently or get the training that is required so that they don't have employers who are, for example, in one case, boss left his penis out for 3 minutes while he was talking to an employee. Don't you think they have the capability of getting the training that they need and the insurance they need before August 1st of 2018 so those kinds of incidents don't happen in small business?
Mr. Hickey.
Regarding the insurance, I've been told many don't have it and many can't afford it and many don't have it. I talked to a few people in the insurance industry today, and that's something small businesses need to look at. But once again, if you really don't know you're going to be around in a year or two, you're really financially challenged. A lot of this you just can't afford. Obviously, everybody needs to do the training, and some of these cases are appalling, I agree. And it's hard to believe this kind of behavior is going on in a workplace. And, and small business needs, like almost all the other actors in our economy, needs to do more to train workers about we don't tolerate this kind of behavior when you go to work, of all places.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hickey, the law right now as it sits actually has the standard substantially interfering in the statute. It was previously in the statute before the federal case law was interpreted. Why do you believe that there will be no standard? Who's advising you? When all the testimony we've heard has said that there is a standard and all the standards are going to be there, you testified you're not a lawyer, so who's telling you that there's going to be this wild west of case law? Because I'm a lawyer, and I just know that that doesn't happen, and so I'm curious as to where you're getting that information and why you believe that to be true.
Mr. Hickey.
Can I make a comment? I'm referring to Minnesota, overturning or not considering the severe or pervasive standard. And I've talked to several employment attorneys. I want to yield to Mr. Erickson here momentarily. But that is the big concern. Obviously, we do have the other standards. But Minnesota saying we're going to overturn this standard, overturn this court case. And obviously, we've had some results that aren't great under it. But this is what's guided the judiciary of the 50 states and the federal government and the federal courts for 30 years. And so, obviously, it's a big change. And nobody can deny it's not a big change. But actually, I want to actually defer to Mr. Erickson because he's been practicing law for a very long time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will just be my last question for Mr. Hickey. Thank you. So, Mr. Hickey,
we heard some testimony that in one of the cases, it was a male who was being grabbed in the testicles by another male and coworker. Do you believe that you would feel harassed if the person sitting next to you now was grabbing your testicles as you were attempting to do your job?
And I don't know that you have to answer that question.
Seriously?
Well,
seriously? Really?
Or Mr. Hickey? Well, I mean...
Madam Chair, the only reason why I say that is because folks are talking about this in the abstract, right? People that are not here, people who have not experienced it, people who are talking about situations that many of them haven't been in. And Madam Chair, I want people to understand that this is what's happening in the workplace. This is the testimony that we've heard. These are the discussions that people are having, and this is why people are suing. And we are deciding right here whether the person next to you, this is our workplace, but the person that is next to you can behave the way these cases are, they're behaving in these cases. That's what we're deciding. Is that okay or is it not okay? Should somebody be able to sue you or should they not? And so I would ask that question of myself, right? Should somebody be able to grab me right here, right now? No. I would feel greatly offended and I would think that that was inappropriate. And I would think that each and every one of us sitting at the table would think that. And so, Mr. Hickey, you don't have to answer that question, but I think I made the point. Right? This is really personal for all of these people that work here. These are employees, many of them. And they participate in, it's a public accommodation, public service, our education. And I think it does create a hostile or offensive work environment. And I think that substantially interfering is an important standard and serious and pervasive based on the cases that we've seen and read, I think is the wrong standard.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on to Mr. Erickson.
Another question here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was kind of late to raise my hand there. Mr. Hickey, we've never met, but I'm looking at your letter that you sent earlier today about, I received it at 1:05 p.m., and didn't have a chance to read it earlier, but I'm kind of scrolling through it now, and I'm just caught by the, I don't know, it's the last sentence in the first paragraph, where you refer to this as good law, that what's in place is good law. Based on the testimony you've heard today, would you still agree with that statement in your letter from earlier today?
Mr. Hickey.
It was not stated in the sense of good or bad. It is the law. It's no. The law they're using.
I'm quoting you, sir. It says good law.
And I'm telling you what I meant.
Okay.
It means it's the law they're utilizing today.
Okay.
Not in good, bad, ugly, nice. It's good law, meaning this is the law they're using.
Well, thank you for the clarification, and perhaps a revised letter would be more appropriate to clarify that. Since you are sending this out to members within this body, and we're all not attorneys, that might be helpful.
Mr. Erickson, go ahead and please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Kurt Erickson. I'm a lawyer at Butler Mendelson in Minneapolis doing labor and employment defense. Before that, I did a wide variety of civil litigation, including on a very limited basis representing a few plaintiffs along the way. In employment matters, or I should say discrimination matters. I'd like to address, I think probably the most important thing to start with here is the idea that we're here to talk about the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We're not here to talk about a circuit law. We're not here to talk about interpretation of Title VII. Ultimately, we're here to interpret and apply the Minnesota Human Rights Act. That's what we can control, and that's what the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals have to apply and interpret. And in Rasmussen versus Two Harbors Fish Company, the Minnesota Court of Appeals reversed an error in a horrendous case involving sex harassment, and said that this clearly was sex harassment, and the Minnesota Supreme Court followed that up, saying that they were remanding that case for trial. So it's probably not what we want to hear here, but the answer is that the Supreme Court is correctly applying the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and it is sending for trial cases that involve actual harassment. And in response, I don't know the names of some of the folks who are here, but there was a question from this side of the table about, well, are there any cases out there where the courts have reversed summary judgment and sent a case back for trial? And I guess I'm just going to read them into the record. It's Petrovic versus Ridgeview Country Club, Minnesota Court of Appeals reverses the summary judgment, sends it back for trial. Gagliardi versus Ortho Midwest, Minnesota Court of Appeals, reverses the summary judgment, sends it back for trial. Devane versus Sears Improvement Products, Minnesota Court of Appeals affirms the judgment of harassment. Andrew Hansen versus Regency Corp, affirming another judge's finding of harassment. Orth versus College of St. Catherine, reversing a summary judgment, sending it back for trial. Jones versus Yellow Freight System, Minnesota Court of Appeals, affirming a judgment, findings of harassment. So there's the court system applying the pervasive, the severe or pervasive standard, which is so important because there's two standards here. There's severe or pervasive. It's not severe and pervasive. That's so critical because there's two pillars here for potential action. When I hear the comments about the Eighth Circuit and Title VII, I understand and respect that position, that we think that positions like in the Duncan versus General Motors case, cases like Alvarez versus Des Moines Bolt, cases like that, to a Minnesotan's frame of mind, seem way out there in terms of saying, how could this not be harassment? But we can't ultimately be distracted by that. We ultimately have to be focused on the law that we're dealing with, and we ultimately have to be focused on the cases interpreting that law. How has the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals interpreted pervasive, severe, or pervasive? They've interpreted it to mean that there has to be an alteration of employment conditions. They've interpreted that in a very, I would say, reasonable light. What they're trying to do is they're trying to sift out what can be completely unacceptable behavior in the workplace, completely unacceptable, but not necessarily discriminatory, not necessarily discriminatory. That's a hard standard, and particularly when you're dealing with human conduct in the workplace, you get all kinds of different human conduct in the workplace. So the courts have come up with a standard that says, listen, if it's frequent, if it's severe, these two potential pillars are implicated, either severe conduct or pervasive conduct. And at that point, and the court, as it's said in many cases, they're not approving of some kinds of conduct, but it's just not rising to the level of really affecting the workplace in terms of the person being discriminated against. What I find remarkable about the discussion of cases like Meritor and cases like that is no meaningful discussions of what the cases are. Meritor is a case where a relatively conservative U.S. Supreme Court said, we're going to decide that harassment is a form of discrimination. In Oncali in 1998, to this representative's question, we're going to decide that male-on-male sex harassment is a form of discrimination. So the arc in the U.S. Supreme Court cases is not so negative as one would think. The arc is actually towards finding and respecting employees in the workplace. That's where we've been headed for the last, I had a case recently, not recently, I should say 1998 or 1999, a case involving the Department of Corrections when I was in state service. And in that case, we had an issue with regard to disability harassment. And the Eighth Circuit found that there wasn't disability harassment in that case, but in so doing, acknowledged implicitly the idea that you can have harassment based on disability that could amount to discrimination and could be a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So the case law is not so negative as I think has been portrayed so far. The case law is designed to try to weed out what is really discriminatory and what really alters the terms and conditions of employment as opposed to being boorish behavior. And, you know, when I say that, when I say boorish behavior, that's the kind of line that you can say and you can almost get beat up about, because it's like, well, isn't this boorish behavior? Isn't that? I mean, haven't we hit the point of being discriminatory or, in fact, harassing? And it's a tough line. It's a tough line to discern. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, the courts are confronted with the harsh truth of having to find that line. And the severe or pervasive standard has helped them do that. So I would respectfully tell you that I don't think that that line ought to be changed. That's completely different than what many people in here are saying. And with regard to the cases that were decided by the federal court, anything that you decide here with regard to what the Minnesota Human Rights Act says with regard to federal law, don't change anything. I mean, to the extent that the Eighth Circuit decided Duncan versus General Motors or Alvarez-Bolt in what you might consider to be a horrendous manner regarding Title VII, nothing you say or do can change that. I mean, that's just the truth. But the other truth is, and I agree with the other speakers with regard to this, Minnesota has been and continues to be a place with progressive legal policies. And as a progressive legal policy, I think the cases that I talked about going back for trial is an indication that the severe and harassment application that the Minnesota courts are applying to facts is, in fact, something in which we're sending cases truly back for trial based on a potential alteration of the conditions of employment. And that's the real bottom line. Have the conditions of employment been changed? If they have been changed in some material way, then, in fact, these cases have been sent back, and I think that's appropriate. I guess I just wanted to add a few other points with regard to this. I mean, when you read, you know, I think folks have been told that Meritor is a terrible case. I would encourage you to look at it, because it's rather a generous case in terms of saying, well, we're going to find that, in fact, harassment equates to discrimination. I think the same is true, as I mentioned, in Oncali. And what I see with regard to taking out the severe and pervasive standard is watering down the issue of whether or not acts are now altering the employment condition. And if they're not doing that, then I don't think that the Human Rights Act ought to be involved in that. I think the Human Rights Act ought to be about actionable sexual harassment, which really is about actionable sexual discrimination. I also worry about the fact that there are a variety of other types of harassment out there. Like I mentioned earlier, I had a case involving alleged disability harassment. Well, there's, in fact, age harassment. Probably more traditionally, there has been racial harassment. Are we going to change the standard with regard to those types of harassment? Are we going to pick and choose with regard to which type of harassment gets a lower standard and which type of harassment gets a higher standard? I would suggest to you that the severe and pervasive standard works for all of them. I'm also struck by the fact, because I represent a lot of employers who are small or medium-sized, that employment lawsuits are horrendous things for them. They are horrendous in the sense that, unlike a typical tort claim, if somebody slips and falls in a parking lot and sues, the only thing that happens, the only potential damages in that situation are whatever happened to the individual plaintiff or the person who slipped and fell and fallen. But in the context of an employment lawsuit, you're getting sued not only for damages, but you're getting sued for attorney's fees. And you're looking at the prospect of having to pay attorney's fees for the person for the person representing you, and you also are looking potentially at paying attorney's fees for the person who is the plaintiff. So it's a double whammy, which is very hard and very difficult on small or medium employers, as Mike talked about. I think that the reality is, with regard to employers' practice liability insurance, that this type of lowering of the standard with regard to severe or pervasive, eliminating it, is going to drive up employers' practice liability rates. I mean, and it's just simple math, ultimately, in the sense that if there are more lawsuits and, you know, insurance companies are interested in settling lawsuits, they're not interested in prevailing in lawsuits. And then there are more costs with regard to those lawsuits, that money has to go somewhere, and that money has to go in terms of increased rates or premiums. I think there's a question over here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair handles the question.
Yeah. Mr. Erickson, you said that when you were talking about the standards and removing this standard, you implicated that severe or pervasive standard was used in other cases, in other types of cases, I should say, in other harassment cases.
Sure.
And you listed off a few items, but
sure.
Is it used in those other cases? Because I thought this was pretty much exclusively for sexual harassment cases.
The case in which, here's what the Eighth Circuit did in the case of Wallen versus the Department of Corrections. In Wallen versus the Department of Corrections, the Eighth Circuit said that we were using a severe or pervasive test, borrowing it from a case called Harris versus Forklift, which is another sexual discrimination case from the U.S. Supreme Court. So the case that I'm referring to is at 153 F3rd 681, Wallen versus the Department of Corrections, 153 F3rd 681.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. You listed a list of cases that
I did
that were remanded or clarified to be actionable. But one thing I noticed when you made the list was that when Ms. Engelmeyer went up there and gave her list, she gave facts of all those cases. And I was wondering, because, you know, if the facts of those cases were, you know, clearly over the top, severe, pervasive, well, it wouldn't be saying much about, you know, whether or not the court handled them that way. So do you have corresponding facts of some of those cases that you listed that were handled, in your opinion, appropriately?
Mr. Erickson.
In terms of Madam Chairman, Representative, the answer is I'm happy to supply those to the committee. I don't have them at my fingertips, but I'm happy to supply them.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Erickson. That would be handy.
Glad to do it.
Because, Ms. Engelmeyer's testimony, I think, was pretty persuasive. But I do have another question for you. You had stated that the Minnesota Human Rights Act was being correctly applied by the courts. I'm wondering if you understand that it's this body that decides what the law is. We write it for the courts to follow. That's sort of a rhetorical question you have to answer because I know you know that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Erickson. When I was in law school, it was in the late 90s, and in your first year, they give you an open brief and a closed brief and a memorandum. I don't know if they did that when you were in law school, but they did for me. And ironically, in the late 90s was the time when my
open memorandum was on this topic. And it was on this, they always make it on an area of trending law, right? It's not something that's clearly established because they want the law students to argue and decide which way is the court's going to go, which way should we go. And it was specifically geared to something you had mentioned, was the court's recognition of same-sex harassment being actionable as sexual harassment, because the law leading up to that time had not recognized that.
Some places had not before Ancali. Not everywhere.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Erickson. And my question relates to that, because prior to that time, there could have been severe and pervasive instances of same-sex sexual harassment, which, through the lens of the law now, would be absolutely actionable. However, the courts changed it to say, hang on a second, we were looking at the law through a dusty, archaic lens. We need to update this because things are getting pretty bad. And I think that's what the proponents of this change are saying, is that things have changed. Just because in the 70s, because your male supervisor did all kinds of sexual things to you and you were a man, it wasn't actual, doesn't mean that's not going to be the case now. So it seems to me you're arguing that we should maintain the status quo, no matter how bad it gets, because we've done it for 30 years. What's your response to that?
Mr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, my response to that is that the framework for deciding the issues is still viable, and that the courts and their decisions in terms of interpreting and applying the Minnesota Human Rights Act in disputes, as they're supposed to be doing, is following that. And I take as evidence the fact that in cases like Rasmussen versus Two Harbors Fish Company, those are cases that were sent back for trial on the issue of hostility, and those are not cases 20 or 30 years ago. The case from the Minnesota Supreme Court in Rasmussen was 2013, and I believe the Court of Appeals decision by Judge Chudich was 2012 in that case. So I don't see us applying an archaic standard. I don't see us not keeping up with the times. What I see us instead doing, what I see the courts doing in Minnesota in particular, is sending these types of cases back for trial. And that's what you want. You know, the big thing here, the dynamic in court is this, in these cases. The dynamic is, can you as a plaintiff get by summary judgment? And from the defendant's standpoint, as a defendant, can you obtain summary judgment? And what the cases that I've talked about stand for are the proposition that the court has said, okay, you get a trial in this case. And that essentially is saying we're going to let the decision maker, in fact, make the fact finder, I should say, make the decision. And that's going to be through direct examination and cross-examination. And that's exactly what we want in cases where there's a genuine factual dispute and there's evidence that it's happening recently, not 30 years ago.
Well, Madam Chair, and this isn't a question for you, Mr. Erickson, it's more of a statement, is when people come in here and propose a language change, it's usually because there's a problem that's perceived. And despite the fact that you state, hey, the court has done a bunch of these cases correctly, that doesn't help me overlook the laundry list of cases provided by Ms. Engelmeyer where they didn't, because of the unjust result. And this body, this committee, is called upon to correct what are largely perceived by, I think, society at large to be unjust results. And, you know, Mr. Hickey can state that no, injustice would result if we did change it, because insurance rates would go up for small businesses. But I would remind you, Mr. Hickey, that most of the time you come in here and say we don't pay those anyway, we pass them on to customers. So actually, you should say customers would pay more, but whatever. In any case, I see the injustice in the cases laid out by Ms. Engelmeyer, and I don't think saying that the court got a bunch of these cases correct helps me overlook those instances. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for this testifier?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am curious as to if you, the testimony, I'm trying to remember, it's getting late, I'm sorry, it's been a long day. The testimony was about how this would just result in more cases being filed and more things ending up in courts and people paying more in their insurance rates and it costing more small businesses more money. But with a delayed effective date of August 1st of 2018, don't you think it could actually change behavior so that we don't have people being treated this way in the workplace?
Mr. Erickson.
No, and I'll tell you why. When I do training for employers, first of all, we're training for employers to avoid things. We're not training to the point of whether this is legal or illegal. We're training to try to get people to be completely courteous and respectful in the workplace. I mean, that's the kind of sex harassment training that not just me, but other people are training on. So that's the type of training that we have now. And I think that that training is generally effective. I mean, I think the good news with regard to the Human Rights Act is, and Title VII and the ADA, is that most employers are trying to get it right. Most employers, I mean, the good news is the fact that we pass these laws, most people are law-abiding and want to do the right thing. I don't think that changing the standard, as a practical matter, I don't think lowering the standard with regard to what's hostile and what's not hostile between now and August 1st, which is approximately, 4 months? I don't think that's going to change anything. I think what it will do, based on the type of lawsuit abuse that I've seen, is that it will encourage people to bring more claims that are right on the edge. And, you know, one of the things that one of the other speakers talked about, I believe, was the fact that a lot of these situations involve just two people with no third-party corroboration of any kind. We're going to have more lawsuits with regard to things that previously were considered not to alter the terms and conditions of employment. And that's going to take a lot of time and expense to deal with.
Representative Hillstrom?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to tell a quick little story. One of the last stories my grandmother told me before she passed away is when she first entered the workforce, she was one of those rosy riveters. And when she first entered the workforce, the rule at work was that every woman had to wear a dress. And back then, they didn't have the backs of the stairs. They only had the one side of the stairs. And the women always had to bring the supplies upstairs to the office. And so every time she had to walk up to the office, all of the men would stand underneath the stairs and look up her dress while she walked up the stairs. She informed me that that was humiliating, and she didn't want to tell her husband. And so she started wearing something underneath her dress, which violated the code of conduct or the dress code that she was supposed to wear for work, but at least it stopped the men from standing under the stairs while she walked up them. Now, she knew that she was violating the rules of work, and she made a choice. What you're saying to me is that the behavior has to be so bad that it has to actually change the arrangement or the agreement for work, right? The workplace relationship. And I don't think we should ask that of anybody. I don't think we should ask that it has to get so bad at work that you actually either have to break the rules or you have to stop going to work or you have to maybe quit your job before it's enough that you should be able to recover. And so I'm not a co-author on the bill. I'm one of the few that haven't yet signed on because I wanted to listen to all the testimony. But I have to tell you, there are real live situations in the workplace where people are being hurt and they are not able to recover, and they are simply leaving their job. They are simply stopping doing it. And some of these cases that we have read have some pretty awful stories behind them. And whether you're a man or a woman, you shouldn't be treated that way at work. And it shouldn't have to come to the point where you want to quit your job or break the rules before you have any recourse. And I'll end.
Can I respond? I would respond to that by saying I've written employer policies on sexual harassment and codes of conduct in the work in which not exactly the behavior that you're talking about has been dealt with. And I've counseled employers regarding behavior very similar to that. And in most cases, employers have either let an employee go with regard to that or otherwise disciplined an employee with regard to that. And I think it goes to the question of your colleague immediately to your right, which shows an evolution with regard to what's going on in the workplace, that, in fact, employers are evolving and that, in fact, employer policies, for example, are addressing the kind of issues that you're talking about there. So I think there has been evolution, not just at the courts, but maybe more importantly in the workplace because of the laws that we passed.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Omar.
Thank you, Jerry Scott. I think you just spoke about an evolution happening because of laws that we pass. And so to Representative Hillstrom's question earlier, whether passing this law is going to create a new evolution in the way employers do their trainings and in the way employees behave, I would say you just answered yes to that question, which you answered no to earlier.
Mr. Erickson.
Yeah, I guess I disagree with that. I don't think this law, unless I've missed something, I don't think this law deals with training. Maybe it does. But what this law deals with, trying to pick out what is, in fact, an alteration of the conditions of employment and what isn't. And I think that that basic paradigm for deciding cases remains the same. I think that what does change is the fact that the courts, as well as society in general, have to keep up with the fact that the work environment is changing and that things such as what happened to your grandmother aren't acceptable anymore. And I would suggest to you that I think that there are a lot of courts that would find that unacceptable. There might be some cases, there certainly could be some cases, courts that would say it was boorish behavior as opposed to unlawful. I don't disagree with that. But I think the general arc has been correct, and I think the standard has generally worked. You know, I remember my first few days of law school, which were before 1990, or the late 1990s, one of our professors said the law is an approximate rule that's approximately enforced. So there's unfortunately always going to be situations where there isn't complete redress of grievances. That'll never stop. But I think that the standard that's in place now works. And I know that that's not necessarily what you want to hear, but I think I genuinely believe that. So there it is for you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
I think there's another question. That guy. No. Yes? Oh, you're just raising
your hand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next person, Melissa Raffin. And on deck, Molly Ryan. And after that, Stacy Seaver. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I am Melissa Raffin, and I very much appreciate your time in allowing me to address the committee. I'm a partner at Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm general counsel to the Minnesota Employment Law Council, which is a group of some of the state's largest employers. I've practiced employment law for over 30 years, and as is true of many of the other speakers, testifiers you've had here tonight, I advise employers regularly, conduct investigations, litigate cases, and train people on sexual harassment. And I represent the full spectrum of employers from, you know, people who are inventing things in their garage to Fortune 500 companies. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the perspective of the employer community on this important issue. know, the Me Too movement has definitely shaken up the employer community and the workplace, and I think all to the good. I think everyone understands that there is a new normal, and what was acceptable 6 months ago is not acceptable today, and that there needs to be greater transparency and greater accountability in the workplace. And what I would also say is since, let's say, the summer of 2017, employees are coming forward and raising concerns and demanding different responses than they did previously, and that is all to the good. And employers are making sure that employees know how to raise their concerns, and once raised, they are addressing them. And I do think, despite what we've heard today about the cases that, with the facts that Ms. Engelmeyer spoke about, Minnesota employers are listening, and Minnesota employers are working hard to create safe workplaces. Madam Chair, just in response to a question that one of the representatives asked, there was a case decided in New York in earlier this year, Swiderski v. Urban Outfitters, that addressed the very issue that was raised. It was about a customer, not an employee, looking up a woman's skirt. And the court was pretty quick to say under the severe or pervasive standard that that conduct was not acceptable. So clearly what was acceptable at one point in time is no longer acceptable. Now, just for the benefit of the committee, employer policies do not train employees on what constitutes sexual harassment. That is not the touchstone in the workplace. The standard for acceptable conduct, depending on how you think about it, is either much lower or much higher, meaning it doesn't need to be severe or pervasive. It doesn't need to, you know, there's no standard that it's applied other than if you find this conduct objectionable, then you should raise your hand and we're going to look into it and address it. Does that mean every concern that an individual raises is substantiated? Absolutely not. And does it mean that some concerns that are raised are substantiated? Absolutely. And I tell you that to say that there's a myriad of concerns raised in every workplace every day, and not all of them are substantiated, not all of them implicate illegal conduct, but employers do take action because the goal is to create a workplace that is respectful where people feel comfortable. Now, we have heard a lot about the severe pervasive standard, and I just wanted to say that there was a question earlier, Madam Chair, about was there any case in which I think a sexual assault was found to be actionable, and there are two cases that I just wanted to respond to. I think it was a question over here, and it's Storley v. Rainbow Foods, 158 F Sup 2nd, 269, and Johnson or Johns v. Harborage, 585 Northwest 2nd, 853. And I simply identify those two cases to make the point that the cases really go every which way. And that some cases that you would think wouldn't advance do, and some cases that you would think would advance won't. But what I would say is this, Madam Chair, that the proposed bill leaves the court without guardrails. The severe or pervasive standard has developed with where the courts look at two things to determine whether it's severe or pervasive. They look at the totality of the circumstances. They look at the frequency. They look at how often the conduct occurred. They look at the relationship between the two people. They look at was one a supervisor, was one a non-supervisor, were they both non-exempt coworkers, were they both co-equal supervisors. It is a totality of the circumstances analysis. In addition, they look at the issue that Commissioner Lindsay raised, which is they look at is it subjectively objectionable, meaning were you offended, and then is it objectively offensive or objectionable, meaning would a reasonable person be offended? And those guardrails are critical to helping courts understand how to analyze these cases. Because even if we were to use the phrase substantial interference, which comes right out of the statute, there is a lot of ambiguity, subjectiveness, and vagueness in that language. And so the goal is really to have an analytical framework that courts can use to look at these cases. Now, this was touched on earlier, but I think it's important and worth speaking about because it hasn't really been delved into, and I think it's important for the committee to consider. If someone wants to bring a sexual harassment claim, they can either go to the Department of Human Rights and file a charge, and then depending on, you know, regardless of what the Department of Human Rights decides, in other words, probable cause or no probable cause, they can then go to court. Or they can go straight to court. As soon as someone files a charge or goes to court, the employer needs to file a response. Oftentimes, employers retain counsel to prepare a charge response to the Department of Human Rights. Clearly, employers hire counsel when a case goes to court. And these cases are incredibly expensive. I don't tell you that to say people shouldn't bring them. I tell you that to say this is very serious business all the way around. For a case to get through summary judgment, and there's so many lawyers in the room that I'm sure reasonable minds could differ, for a case to get through summary judgment, it is going to be at least $50,000 for the employer, if not more. For a case to get through trial, we're looking at well into the six figures. And I think the reason that that is critical is to understand that employers do take these cases extremely seriously. Nobody takes this lightly. Now, the goal really, I think, probably of the behind the bill is really to create safe workplaces. And, you know, as I said, employers have always worked hard, and the 30 years I've been doing this, that's been my observation, but I would say there's been an added energy and momentum brought to this since the summer of 2017. And they're really focusing on policy reporting and resolution and really creating an inclusive environment in which people come forward and raise their concerns. The bill that has been proposed as it stands to simply remove severe or pervasive, or I apologize, I misspoke, to add in the language saying it does not need to be severe or pervasive, would really result in unpredictable outcomes. It is not simple. It is not a simple bill that resolves all of the issues because we are taking away the guardrails. It is a complicated issue, and the real winners will be the lawyers. Something that was pointed out, and I just want to underscore it, in these cases, plaintiffs' lawyers get attorney's fees. And this may be the seamy side of the legal profession, but the plaintiffs' lawyers get a 30, and now it's a 40% contingent fee in these cases. And I'm not saying necessarily that they bring these cases to get their contingent fee, but the real winners with an ambiguous bill are the lawyers. It's sort of the Full Employment Act for lawyers. So I think to say that that bill could be passed where the statute would simply be amended by adding one sentence is an oversimplification of a complicated process where the language needs to be very carefully considered. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I missed your last name.
Rafan.
Ms. Rafan. Plaintiff's lawyers only get attorney's fees if they actually win. Isn't that correct?
Ms. Rafan.
Madam Chair, plaintiff's lawyers get attorney's fees if they get any dollars on the case. So if they settle the case, they get their fee.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked the last two testifiers. There's an effective date of August 1st of 2018, so no actions that happened before, only actions that have to happen after August 1st of 2018. If employers have this new level of energy that you testified about and are changing the workplace, don't you believe that ultimately if we give this effective date that we'll actually change behavior in the workplace and actually make workplaces more safe for all employees?
Ms. Rafan.
I'm sorry. I could I have that question repeated? I didn't understand the last part of the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's a delayed
effective date on the bill and actions after August 1st of 2018 would have this new standard. So don't you believe that by giving this a delayed implementation date, right, we're giving employers time to train their employees, talk to their employees, address any issues they have in the workplace. Don't you believe that having this new standard will actually improve workplace safety for everyone?
Ms. Rafan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't believe that the delayed implementation date will cure the subjectivity and vagueness of the proposed bill.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you believe with a lower standard allowing people to get to court, with a lesser standard than the federal standard, that that won't motivate employers to ensure that their employees comply with the law or behave in a way that doesn't violate the law?
Ms. Rafan.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that's the case. And the reason I say that is right now employers themselves impose a lower standard in their own workplaces. What we are talking about is imposing a lower standard for judges to try and apply. And when I talk about the guardrails, I just want to go back to that. We talk about a totality of the circumstances approach and the objective and subjective. These are the guardrails that have grown up around the severe or pervasive standard. So without those guardrails, I don't believe that we're going to have safer workplaces. I don't think that having uncertain and unpredictable outcomes is going to benefit the workplace.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will then just be my last question. So if ultimately it is the legislature's goal to improve workplace safety and you believe that changing the standard by which their behavior is going to be measured isn't the right thing to do, what is the right thing to do? Is mandatory training by employers of employees? I mean, what is it that the legislature should be doing to ensure that this bad behavior isn't happening in the workplace?
Ms. Rafan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So the first thing I would like to say, and I do feel compelled to say this because I've listened to the testimony, what we are talking about does not happen every day in every workplace. Like, with all due respect to Ms. Engelmeyer, and I do admire her command of the case law, she is picking outrageous outlier cases in some instances. So I just think we have to put that in context. If you were to ask me how could we improve the workplace without changing the standard, what I would talk about is exactly what you touched on, and that is creating what can be done exactly in the workplace. I don't believe that going to court to resolve your disputes is going to make the workplace better. I don't believe changing the legal standard is going to make the workplace better in this instance, given that we have a legal standard and we have a body of case law. So if you want to really change what's happening in the workplace, then I would say talking about mandatory training is what I would talk about.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No question, but comment. Ms. Rafan, first of all, I'd estimate north of two-thirds of the bills brought before this legislature and that come through this committee deal with the outrageous outlier cases. So the list that was brought forth by Ms. Engelmeyer, that's why we have bills in front of these committees. I mean, we don't pass laws when things are going hunky-dory. So when there's a problem, we're asked to address it, and we do address it. And I had the same question as Representative Hillstrom. I want to ask you, but you know, we write the laws here. We can write whatever guardrails we want. So if there are better guardrails, there are a lot of open ears around this table that are willing to consider what those guardrails should be. But more my point was, when I asked to be recognized, Madam Chair, was related to something that bothered me. Maybe it shouldn't bother me because maybe I misunderstood the way that you you said it, but that these cases get brought by plaintiff's attorneys motivated by money. And I felt like that was kind of a mischaracterization of the way things work. I mean, it's like saying, where does food come from in America? Well, it comes from the drive-through window at McDonald's. It skips through a bunch of steps of what happens. I mean, you have your job. You get paid because attorneys bring cases, and you get paid by employers to defend them against attorneys who bring cases. So everyone's in the same boat on this, but the attorneys who are bringing cases because they see injustice. And you don't get sued for attorney's fees. You have to pay the prevailing plaintiff when they prove a hostile environment. And the objective is for the employer to stop allowing that to happen. So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the responsible party is the employer who is supposed to change their policies or how they're or get rid of the person who's causing the problem. And yeah, it's scary. As Mr. Hickey said before, well, this is stressful to be sued. Absolutely it's stressful to be sued. It's supposed to be stressful to be sued. When I was prosecuting for all those years, people walk into the courtroom and they say, this is ridiculous, this is intimidating. It's supposed to be intimidating. It's supposed to impress upon you that something really big is happening. So I just wanted to say that I think that the people, and I think you probably know that as well, Ms. Rafan, that bring these cases serve a very important function in getting to the cultural change in workplaces that we're trying to achieve here. That's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so confused because your testimony is kind of conflicting in my mind with the Human Rights Commissioner Lindsay's testimony, because we've been talking about if we're removing severe or pervasive from the, because that's federal, so we're reverting back to the human rights statutes, and then the Human Rights Commissioner comes to testify to talk about that the guardrails that are there are matters of objectivity and subjectivity, that's still there, and totality of circumstances still there. So I'm just really confused because your testimony is completely different than what he said. So if he's the Human Rights Commissioner, I would think he would know what the human rights statute says. So can you help me understand? I mean, it's just completely different than what the Human Rights Commissioner's testimony was, very clearly stating that there are still guardrails within the human rights statute and maintaining the objectivity and subjectivity standard and the totality of circumstance standard. So help me understand.
And if I could add to that, the other guardrail is the substantially interfering the law itself. So, Ms. Rafan.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I appreciate the question. And just to be very clear, substantial interference is in the statute. That is correct. Totality of the circumstances is not in the statute. And subjective and objective are not in the statute. They are case law principles that have developed around the severe or pervasive standard. So when Commissioner Lindsay is talking about those as being part of the analytical framework, it would have to be written in. It is not in today. And if you remove severe or pervasive, those guardrails will fall away.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if maybe the previous testifier and the commissioner could come up, because I'm still very confused.
I believe the commissioner left, but Ms. Engelmeyer, is that who you're referring to?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome back to the table, Ms. Engelmeyer. Representative O'Neill, do you want to restate your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so the question was, I'm just really confused, because the Human Rights Commissioner came up and talked about that the guardrails were still there because they were part of the human rights statute, and he talked about, I asked him specifically about objectivity and subjectivity, and then I'd also like to know about totality of circumstance. And so if we remove the severe or pervasive, are we still left with objectivity, subjectivity, also what was already in statute, which I can read clearly, which was
substantially
interfering, thank you, and then also the totality of circumstances.
Ms. Engelmeyer.
Thank you. So let me start by saying a couple of times, Representative O'Neill, you have used the phrase, we are removing the severe or pervasive standard. That's not right, and I want to make sure everybody considering this understands the difference. The fact is, when the law defined sexual harassment in 1982, it defined it as set forth in Subdivision 43, which you all have in front of you. It does not use the word severe or pervasive. It was never in it. That was something invented by the federal jurisprudence over time, much later. What every lawyer in this room knows who practices employment law is there's to prove a hostile work environment, you have to show conduct related to a protected category that's offensive, that's unwelcome, and that is so severe or pervasive it affects a term or condition of employment. The only of those things on my hand that we are talking about is having a statement that it doesn't have to be so severe or pervasive. So then what you're left with is conduct related to a protected category that's offensive, that is unwelcome, and that substantially interferes with your work environment. So you have tons of guardrails there among those existing other elements. It's much like under the Americans with Disabilities Act when it was amended. The Americans with Disabilities Act says once you prove you're disabled, you have to be reasonably accommodated. When the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act passed, they said quit focusing on who's disabled and start focusing on whether you can accommodate. This bill is designed to quit focusing on severe or pervasive and start focusing on what's in the language already, whether it interferes with the work.
But I would, may I, Madam Chair?
Profan.
The totality of the circumstances does not appear in subdivision 43 of the statute or anywhere else in the statute. That is the analytical framework that the courts have created. That is judicially created. That is not in the statute.
But no. Mr. Fan, isn't that used in other areas of law as well as a standard?
Totality of the circumstances. It is used in other areas, but in this context it has developed out of the severe or pervasive standard. So we are simply saying if you are going to add language to the statute that says the conduct does not need to be severe or pervasive, then you would also want to add language saying that you have to consider the totality of the circumstances and the conduct must be objectively and subjectively objectionable, whatever the language is.
Ms. Engelmeyer?
I would just want to say that I think we would, for the most part, agree on the law. And my recollection of the law is that totality of the circumstances is used to measure all of those things I put on my hand, not just severe or pervasive. It's used to measure, does it affect a term or condition of employment? Is it welcome? All of those things. So I do not believe totality of the circumstances is going away, because there's nothing in the statute. Could there be language clarifying more? Of course there could. But this language does not take anything away except the severe or pervasive component of the case law. As far as I'm concerned, the legislative history can make clear that the rest of the case law stands, other than that aspect.
Representative O'Neill, were you finished?
Thank you. Representative Carlson and then Representative Howe, do you have a question? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Rafan, I'm just going to keep going on this a little bit because there seems to be some contradictions between your earlier testimony and what you are now saying. So it does appear that we have some guardrails. And to your comment that the only way to address this would be through training, do you want to maybe spend some time talking about that for a second as to why, based on where we started with your testimony and where we are now, if training still is the solution that you would recommend to this body?
Ms. Rafan.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, my testimony has not changed. It has been consistent throughout because the standard, the language that Representative O'Neill asked about, does not appear in the statute. I just want to comment on one thing. I think Ms. Engelmeyer's point that it is contained in the legislative history, I believe there's been some research done looking into whether the legislative history would apply. And I think given that we already have two lawyers right here disagreeing on whether it's clear that totality of the circumstances is still the approach, I think that sort of proves the point and it should go into the statute. In terms of Representative Carlson's question, I think Representative Carlson, my point simply was a little bit different perhaps than the question, and that is workplace disputes are best resolved in the workplace. And the question I think asked by one of your colleagues was, what would be something that the legislature could do to capture the momentum and energy of the Me Too movement in the workplace? And the suggestion that I made was that it could be a training requirement. That certainly would be a way to do it. Having litigated these cases for 30 years, I don't think that the best outcome for any workplace issue is the courtroom.
Representative Carlson? Representative Powell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is going to come into something that's in the statute. I see that we're not going to, if we don't use the severe or pervasive, and that doesn't have to be used, I tried to find the definition of substantially interfering. And every instance that I could find online here referred to property law. There's nothing that I could find in employment law relating to substantially interfering. So I don't know who wants to give me that definition, but I'll take it from anybody. So what's substantially interfering when we're talking about labor law and in contents of this statute?
I don't know if House research.
I would care
too. Oh. The testifiers at the table, you want to take a stab at substantially interfering? The one from Ms. Rafan.
I have the same question. I mean, I don't know. And that's exactly like we already, two people have the question, you know, how are we going to leave it to a court to interpret it?
Is it how?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Engelmeyer.
Thank you. So the case law as it currently exists has two aspects. Is it so severe or pervasive that it affects a term or condition of employment? For example, in the Paula Jones case, an Arkansas case that from the federal jurisprudence, they analyzed the issue of what was interfering with work. And they determined she was able to go to work. She was able to, she got raises, that sort of thing. There are many cases that address the issue about what is interfering with work. What has happened, though, over the last 20 years, and I draw your attention to the fact that Ms. Rafan is a brilliant lawyer, so is Mr. Erickson. And between them, they came up with less than 10 cases where an employee was successful, had a chance for a day in court. In my article that I have submitted to the Workplace Safety Committee, I list all the cases, good and bad. They're all there, meaning an employee successful, employee not successful. And those less than 10 cases that they came up with by themselves are over a 30-year period. One of the cases that was cited by Mr. Erickson is back more than 20-some years ago. If in that time we only have less than 10, what has happened in the courts is that people don't even look at what is enough to substantially interfere because they're comparing. This case says four touches aren't enough. Well, if four aren't enough to be severe or pervasive, nobody even gets to the second half of the inquiry very often. And so that's where we're stuck. And that's why there aren't a lot of cases, is because it's all looking at prior cases, what's severe, what's pervasive, and they don't get to the second half of the question. And what this legislation would do would force folks to focus on the second half of the equation.
Representative Powell.
I think there needs to be a definition. Thank you.
Any other questions for these two testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Molly
thank
Ryan
you.
And Stacy Siever. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for having me. I've never done this before, so...
We're kind.
A couple hours I've tried to learn. how it works.
Sure, no worries. We're kind. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Molly Ryan, and I am an attorney at Mayer & Gear, and I am also a co-chair of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association Employment Law Committee, and I am here in that context. So a lot of what I was planning to say has been covered, but in the employment context, the Minnesota Human Rights Act prohibits conduct or communication based on sex that alters the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. The severe or pervasive standard ensures that the Minnesota Human Rights Act does not become a general civility code for the American workplace, or to make actionable the ordinary tribulations of the workplace, or conduct that's merely rude or unpleasant. The severe or pervasive standard filters out complaints relating to such conduct and limits actionable claims to those based on conduct that in fact alters the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. The standard was developed by the judiciary, and the judiciary is a proper venue to address the application of the standard on a case-by-case basis, given the specific facts, the totality of the circumstances at issue in the case. The legislature's proposed amendments to the Minnesota Human Rights Act eliminating the standard would be a dramatic change in the law, and it would leave the court with absolutely no guidance on how sexual harassment claims should be analyzed. This would result in an incredible burden on the courts, both in determining how to analyze sexual harassment claims and the dramatic increase in the number of sexual harassment claims that will flood the state court's dockets. Plaintiffs will bring all sexual harassment claims in state court, where there's no administrative prerequisite, resulting in a significant additional burden to our already overburdened judiciary and leaving the courts to analyze claims with no guidance in how to do so. It appears that the authors of this bill believe that some courts have gone too far in determining what's severe or pervasive. But then let's talk about what might be a better, more workable standard. Not eliminate the standard entirely without providing guidance on what is actionable sexual harassment under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Simply, I don't think that the solution is in the proposed amendment, which eliminates the standard entirely. We need a line drawn. Maybe some folks think that the line needs to be moved from where it is now, given some of the decisions that have been issued by the courts. But at a minimum, we need a line. And where that line should be drawn, a workable standard for everybody, should be properly analyzed, with all the folks who have a stake in this having an opportunity to be heard. Rather than trying to pass this particular legislation without a sufficient opportunity to consider the significant impact such legislation will have on the fairness of the playing field. The goal is to level the playing field with regard to these claims. However, this amendment would completely eliminate it. Such a result is not reasonable, and it's not fair, particularly given the manner in which it's occurring. Therefore, I respectfully request that the proposed amendment be rejected, and if the legislature plans to eliminate the severe or pervasive standard, then the legislature must provide some alternative guidance on what's actionable sexual harassment under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Lesh?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, it was Ms.
Ryan.
Ms. Ryan. So you stated that this is not fair, particularly under the circumstances in which it's arising. How did you mean?
Ms. Ryan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I believe that, this is a proper decision for the courts. Ms. Engelmeyer mentioned how Judge Dickstein was pleading for, some assistance here and his hands being tied. I mean, Judge Dickstein said at least twice in the opinion that this is a matter for the courts to decide. I think that this is a matter for the courts to decide, and I also think that if the legislature is going to be deciding on this issue, I think that it would be appropriate to get broader feedback and maybe perhaps a task force or something to look at this issue and decide what would be the appropriate standard, rather than leave it with no standard at all.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair and Ms. Ryan, we write the laws in this state. Well, the legislature writes the laws in every state, for that matter, too. And, you know, the courts are free to interpret them. But as far as setting guidelines or rules, That happens in this committee. It may well be that you don't like the direction the committee is going, and so you would prefer the matter to be litigated in the courts if you have a better chance, but you would be in a very large group of people who operate the same way. However, I just wanted to point out that this is the way we do things around here. Now, your point's suggesting that, you know, you think there should maybe be a working group is fair, but, you know, I just would state that Majority Leader Pepin's actions in her subcommittee is what was tantamount to the working group that resulted in this suggestion that led us to having this discussion here today. So I just want to point that out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any more questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had said that, as Representative Lesh kind of pointed out, that the burden should be on the court, which I think Justice Paul Anderson would vehemently disagree with, as was already stated in the previous testimony. I just wanted to point that out as well. And also, you state that this just isn't fair, and I would argue that 10 cases in 20-some years that actually prevailed is not fair. And the standard we have right now is not fair. And from someone that suffered 18 months of horrendous sexual harassment, where I was taken to foreign countries and raped by my boss, I would say that's not fair. So I'm looking out for the victims of sexual harassment. I'm speaking for their voices. That's what's not fair. So if only 10 cases have prevailed in Minnesota in 2 decades, I'd say that's not fair.
Any other comments or questions for this testifier? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Stacey Seaver. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. My name is Stacey Seaver. I practice at Stitch Angel in Minneapolis. I have represented plaintiffs, both male and female, in sexual harassment cases. I've represented employers, and I've also represented what we call the bad guy, the guy who got fired for being accused of sexually harassing or assaulting someone. And it's very late. We've all been awake for a very long time, so I will try to cut to the chase. I really enjoyed the discussion tonight, especially the discussion with attorneys Engelmeyer and Rafan. And I think that discussion illustrates the fact that we need more time and analysis as to what the modification to the law should be. I agree that the standard of severe or pervasive has been convoluted and applied in unfortunate ways over the years. But the amendment as proposed is not going to solve the problem. In fact, I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences as a result of this amendment. I'd like to actually look at the language, because there's been a lot of contradiction and kind of convoluting as to what is actually being referred to here. So as Ms. Engelmeyer mentioned, we are only talking about the hostile work environment portion of this statute, Section 3. So if we look at that, there are two parts to this Section 3. The first one, the conduct or communication has the purpose or effect of, number one, substantially interfering with an individual's employment, public accommodations or public services, education or housing. Or, and I would argue, if I was advocating in court, this is the second part of this subsection, creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment, public accommodation, public services, educational, housing environment. Now, the amendment only speaks to the second part. It does not touch on this first part, I would argue in court, the substantially interfering part. So we are not talking about substantially interfering behavior. Now, as Representative Lesh has mentioned a number of times, it is your job as legislators to set forth the law in a clear manner. It is the court's job to interpret the language that you've enacted. And the first tenet of the courts is that where the language is plain,
and clearly stated that's exactly what they're going to do. It's my job as the attorney to advocate and try to convince the judge that my reading of the law is correct. So if there's any ambiguity, I would ask you as the legislatures to please look back at your language and make sure what the plain language of this amendment is going to do is what you really mean to do. By taking out what is 30 years of case law, I agree with Attorney Rafan. You are removing the guidelines, the guide rails that the courts have been using. By taking out severe or pervasive, as an advocate in court, I would say the only thing that I need to show here is that this behavior created an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment circumstance, housing circumstance, educational, etc. That means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, the discussion about less than 10 cases have gone forward. These are case law examples. I didn't come here with a list of cases. I will tell you, thousands of cases settled. Thousands of cases settled because, as another testifier mentioned, it costs tens of thousands of dollars to litigate these cases for defendants. And the risk is high. If they push this, they incur $100,000 in attorney's fees to push this through trial, they may get allocated also the plaintiff attorney's fees. Now, the thing about the attorney's fees provision, it does not have to be proportionate to the damages. I tried one of those cases as a defendant, and I lost. The conduct was very minor. The verdict award was very minor. It was a small amount awarded. But my client had to pay nearly $200,000 in attorney's fees to the other side because they were the prevailing party. This is a significant risk for businesses, specifically small businesses. And in this case, I think that this amendment, while I would appreciate your work in bettering the law to protect sexual harassment victims in this state, this is not the way to do it. I think we need more time to work on the language, to work on definitions, to better define exactly what we are doing here, to give better guidance to the businesses of the state and to the courts as to how we are going to best eliminate sexual harassment in this state.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for this testifier? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Manager. One of the things that you said about the case that you tried where there was $200,000 in attorney's fees awarded, how was it a minor incident but the court found it severe and pervasive in order to lose?
Ms. Stever.
Your Honor, excuse me.
It's all right. We do it all the time.
Representative, so to be severe or pervasive, that is, as we've talked about, that's kind of the landmark you need to get to, mm-hmm. Okay? And then it's a question of fact. All the facts, the circumstances get presented to the jury. The jury weighs the credibility. The jury looks at whether the plaintiff was damaged or not, whether the conduct was severe, whether it met the criteria. Okay? And so the jury came back, and a jury of Minnesota voters and constituents came back and said, yes, we believe that this happened, and yes, it was wrong. But it was not significant enough, it was not severe enough to warrant a large damage award. So that's how that happened. It did meet the legal standard. It went to the jury. They determined against my client, and that's how we got the verdict.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to comment. So if your client was proved to have been wrong and to have met the standard of severe and pervasive, I think he should pay. I think that kind of conduct is not appropriate, and I think he should pay. And the fact that he got lucky and maybe she didn't have to go to therapy and she didn't have a lot of medical expenses or she didn't have a lot of lost work is lucky for her,
but shame on him. And so I am not concerned when it goes to a jury and a jury finds that there was severe and pervasive conduct. I am not one bit concerned that he had to pay legal fees and should have had to pay a lot more if that conduct even met that standard, that's all I'll say.
Representative, I appreciate your point, and I agree if someone does wrong, they should pay. My point in bringing up that story is, what was the driver in that case? It was not the plaintiff. It was not for her benefit. It was an attorney who made a heck of a lot of money doing that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say, it's hard for us to know that because we don't know the facts. Maybe she was looking for something else, right? Maybe she wanted a resignation. Maybe she wanted something else. There's a whole bunch of things that people want out of a court case that don't necessarily have anything to do with the dollars. And, we, again, unless we're going to get into the nitty-gritty details of what the facts of the case were so we could make a full evaluation, I think I'm just going to leave the comments there.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Siever, you had mentioned in your testimony that thousands of these cases settle before they ever reach any kind of fact pattern that can be analyzed in a holding. Is that right?
Yes, Ms. Siever.
Thank you, Ms. Siever, Madam Chair. Ms. Siever, that many cases that are going on, how effective do you think these current guardrails are at stopping the behavior that we're trying to prevent?
Ms. Siever.
Representative, I would say that I'm sure you've heard some statistics, you're a lawyer, that something like 95% of all cases settle, right? And that's because people want to avoid the hassle of a lawsuit. They want to avoid the expense. There's a number of reasons. And in several cases, in many cases, they know they were wrong. I would say that's true of some defendant decisions to settle. But I cannot give you numbers, but I'm telling you that one of the driving decision-making criteria in these cases is the huge amount of attorney's fees and the strain and the stress that puts on an employer, a small business.
And Ms. Siever, you had stated, and several other testifiers have stated, that with the removal of these really important guardrails, the courts would be essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, be left rudderless without an ability to operate. But as Engelmeyer pointed out in her testimony, we passed our law in 1982, okay? In 1986, 4 years later, the Minnesota Supreme Court dragged and dropped federal standard on top of the Minnesota Human Rights Act that we wrote. So it doesn't seem like the courts are going to be that impaired if we remove this criterion, and they want to just make up another one, because they did that in 1986. They do that consistently around here. Everyone around this table knows that they do their own thing, and we have to come back and clarify. So it's not so much a question, because it's rhetorical, of course, but I just don't buy it that this is a major problem. The court's going to be left rudderless without a standard, where if, in fact, it is that much of a problem, they'll go make up their own immediately, and we'll have the same discussion here next year, which we always do anyway. That's all.
Representative, if I'm...
Ms. Siever.
Just briefly, I would say, Representative Lesch, I'm asking you to define it so that the courts do not have to legislate from the bench. Just please give us a clear standard, give us a definition, give us something that is clear so that we don't have to look to the courts and judges to do that.
Madam Chair, listen, I want to get back and forth with this, but Ms. Siever, you probably don't spend a lot of time around here, because I could count, I don't have enough fingers to count the number of times that we have made it indelibly clear to the courts of what we mean in black and white. There's no question about it. Any sane person could read the words and see it, and they still go make up their own thing. So I'm just saying the argument doesn't wash, that's all.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The to that topic, the since I've joined the legislature here now, I think it was in 2017, we're finally dealing with frivolous ADA lawsuits that are because of a ambiguous law that was in 1990. It was like almost three decades over time. I'm concerned also about the lack of clarification on the guardrails and the winners on these cases not being the actual victims. So it's just a statement that that's a concern I have.
Thank you, Representative Lunin. Any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin? Oh, well, actually, I need to ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill. Okay, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you.
Please,
good evening.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Leslie Lieneman. I will be very brief. I have practiced as a plaintiff's employment lawyer since 1992. I am one of those attorneys that you have heard are the beneficiaries of this statute, and I'm here to tell you that's not the case. I have been the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Employment Lawyers Association.
Could you speak up just a little bit, please? Thank you.
Yes, I am currently the president of the Employee Lawyers Association of the Upper Midwest. I have participated as an amicus writer before the Minnesota Courts of Appeals and Supreme Court, and I believe 17 cases addressing the important issues of the Minnesota Human Rights Act and others. I can tell you that this statute is very important to the men and women of the state of Minnesota. And you should ask yourselves, if the plaintiff's attorneys in the state of Minnesota do not take on these cases, who will enforce this statute? It will not be the Minnesota Department of Human Rights because they don't have the budget. Since 1992, I have represented hundreds of women, all on contingent fee basis. That means that every time that I take on a case, I put my life on the line with it, my ability to put food on the table for my child, to pay for his education, to pay my staff. We do not take those risks lightly. If we lose, we don't pay our bills. We do not bring frivolous cases. We take cases for the women who suffer, as you have heard today, many of them do, and also for some men who suffer these indignities in the workplace as well. So I would encourage you to look precisely at what this statute and this amendment is aimed to do, which is to look at whether the severe and pervasive severe and pervasive federal standard has a place in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, not at what attorneys are being paid or what the trial results might be for those few cases that are allowed to go to trial, but rather what was the point of passing this statute and giving it this definition so long ago in 1982 or in 1980 when Continental Can was decided. Was it to allow victims of harassment who suffer daily intimidation and harassment a forum and a remedy? Because if that is your intent, then you should leave the statute as it was originally written and explain to the courts in Minnesota that here in Minnesota, our standard is not severe and pervasive, but rather it is whether the conduct is of a sexual nature and creates an intimidating or hostile environment. And juries are very well suited to decide those issues because juries are made up of everyday people like you and me and everyday workers, and they are well able to interpret this those types of terms just as they are the terms that you decide to put in any other statute. There's nothing unclear about this statute. There are guardrails in place. You have to trust that the people of Minnesota, the juries, will be able to determine what is hostile or offensive, and they will be objective because there will be 6 or 12 of them. That's where the objective standard comes in. When you have a jury of your peers, it builds in the objectivity and eliminates the possibility that a plaintiff will prevail who does not have a legitimate claim. I thank you very much for your time for allowing me to speak.
Thank you for being here for your testimony. Ms. Lineman, are there any questions for this testifier? Thank you very much. Representative Pepin.
think it would be okay if I could have Ms. Engelmeyer answer or get a little wrap.
Okay, sure.
Just one thing I wanted to say, Representative Lunan, you raised an excellent point that we don't want to have unclear standards. And some of the lawyers who I've testified before you have acted as though severe or pervasive is a clear standard. If you read my article, which details how that standard has shaken out over the last 30 years, the cases are all over the map. There is nothing clear about it. So simply saying that we want to go back to the language that was passed in 1982 based on the Continental Can case seems like a smart choice to me and a lot more clear than what we're seeing now.
Go ahead, Representative Lunan.
Thanks. And I'd like to respond to that. So then it's your testimony that standards do need to exist, or we need to put some boundaries in on what is and what isn't?
Yes, and I think it's already there in the statute.
Representative Lunan. Go ahead, Ms. Engelmeyer, if you have further comments.
I apologize that I spoke too soon, Representative Lunan. Yes, I think we need standards, and I think they exist in the statute as it's written.
Okay. Do you have any other closing comments?
I do not.
Okay. Representative Pepin.
Thank you. All right. Well, first of all, I appreciate everybody for, taking several hours tonight, all the witnesses that came forward, and, of course, the members for coming forward. Regarding the standards, just a couple of things. First of all, I think it is laid out in the statute already as is. But I also want to point out we do have information from our legal research, and I also want to be clear that my intent is not to change anything else. Any of those other court standards and case law that has been established, including things such as the subjective and objective standard, the reasonable person, the totality of the circumstances, all of those things, I'm not saying anything in this bill that should be removed. So that is the intent. I think everybody should know that that's what it is going forward. I also have a legal brief here from our House Legal Research Department that says that there's no other language in the bill addressing other established precedents related to these types of cases, such as the subjective-objective standard and the reasonable person standard used for this interpreting the impact of the harassing conduct or other established precedents in this area. It does not seem likely that the courts would abandon all other precedent used to interpret the statute because the legislature has acted to direct the courts away from a single specific standard. So I want to be clear that that is my intent. If there is going forward some need that we need to, somehow write that in, I'll continue to work on that. But overall, members, I'd just like to say that Minnesota has led in this issue, as we do in so many issue areas. This is not a partisan issue. We are the legislature, the ones creating the law. I think we're the ones, as Representative Lesh pointed out, that's what we do. We hold election certificates. We come here so that we can address these things that need to be changed, that have sometimes gone astray in the court system for whatever reasons. It's been a long time. We need to take a look at this. It has gone off the rails from where it should be, and we have an opportunity to be the nation's leader in this. And I believe that if we have the courage to move forward and pass this in Minnesota, I believe other states are going to follow us. And I believe it's the right thing to do in the workplace, and it'll address many of the concerns that have come forward, and it will address the changing nature of the workplace in a positive way. And so I don't want you to look at this as though we're some kind of an outlier if we change this. I hope you don't look at it that way. I think that we would once again be leading the nation in making sure that the victims that we talked about in many of the cases, they actually have their day in court. These horrific things have happened to people, and it is our job as a legislature to make sure that we're giving people a system where they can come forward and have their day in court and make sure that they can provide, they have to still, prove the evidence and prove their case. But if that's not happening now, how is that going to change unless we have the courage to come forward and do something about it? So with that, members, I certainly hope you will allow this bill to move forward.
Can I make one comment briefly, Chairperson?
Sure. Go ahead.
Sure.
Ms. Engelmeyer.
I just want to clarify. This bill, as I understand it, is not changing the legislation. It's restating that the legislation that was passed in 82 and telling the courts that the deviation that they have done in raising the severe pervasive standard over the 20 years I've been watching it, it's only gone up. You're trying to unwind that.
Correct. Thank you. Well, I want to thank members and testifiers and those of you waiting in the wings for your bill to come up for persisting with this. I think we had a really good discussion. I think it's a balancing act, and I think there are some discussions that still need to happen on this bill and on the language to just make double, triple sure that what we do here is the right thing. And so I want to thank the majority leader for bringing the bill and all of you. And with that, we will go ahead and take a vote. All those in favor of passage of House File 4459 and having it re-referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Representative Dabney. And thank you, Representative Keel, for letting Representative Dabney go first.
Good evening, Madam Chair, and yes, thank you to Representative Keel, and thank you to the Chair for the indulgence of civilians in the room.
Right.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Dabney. And this, just for members of the audience, if you weren't aware, this is just an informational hearing, and I had spoken with Representative Dabney several weeks ago, and we were button right up to deadline, and I said, he told me about this bill, I was interested, and so I said, we'll give you an informational hearing, and so here we are at almost 10:30 at night, but let's do it.
All right, Lev. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you for this opportunity. This is the product of some conversations I've had with a group in Hennepin County, the Mapping Prejudice Project. The team is here. And it is regarding racially restrictive covenants that are present in the abstracts, land titles, to homes in Hennepin County, homes in various counties across the state. And, you know, Madam Chair, you had some rather unusual vocabulary used in the last hearing, and a little uncomfortable and not the stuff we normally hear in legislative hearings. I'm going to add to that to make sure that people understand what we're talking about when we talk about racially restrictive covenants on land. The covenants, of course, govern the use of the land. The covenant that the Mapping Prejudice team was good enough to find on my own home, an average home in a middle-class neighborhood in South Minneapolis, says this. The land was first sold in 1919, and the woman who owned the farm that was divided into the lots hand wrote on the abstract the following, quote, "Property shall not be sold, leased, mortgaged, or transferred to any person of the Negro race or to any person living with a person of the Negro race, and said second party hereby agrees that if said property should ever be sold, leased, mortgaged, or transferred to a person of the Negro race, or any person married to or living with a person of the Negro race, the title thereto shall immediately revert to and vest in the fee in first party her heirs and assigns." Yes. The language limited and prohibited who could live, buy, occupy my property. And it's not just my property, and it's not just Minneapolis or Hennepin County. This work that the Mapping Prejudice team is doing is similar to work done in Washington State, Wyoming, Oregon, California, Kansas, communities that are looking deep into land records and finding a history that few of us knew about and few of us are going to be comfortable with. The bill, House File 2767, would allow landowners whose abstracts contain such racially restrictive covenants to respond to that and to discharge those covenants while retaining, and these folks are history folks, so this is important to them, while retaining the language of the covenant in the abstract. This is a historical document. What we're trying to do is respond to the history, not change the history. With that, why don't I, if I may, Madam Chair, pass it over to Kevin Erman Solberg from the Mapping Prejudice Project. He's much better able to walk you through the process.
Great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kevin Erman Solberg, and thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin Erman Solberg. I'm the project manager for the Mapping Prejudice Project, and we're located at the University of Minnesota at the Borchardt Map Library, and for some reason, there we go. We're looking at the Borchardt Map Library, and we're also cooperating with the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs and CPED. And what we're trying to do, what we're attempting to do, is to build the first comprehensive spatial database, or map, if you will, of racial covenants for any city in the country. So there has been some work in places like Washington, both state and D.C., but nobody's ever actually gone through the entirety of the property record and mapped all of these things out. So we simply just don't know how common these were, how pervasive they are, which neighborhoods were restricted and which ones were not. And that's what we're attempting to do. And we're still a project in progress. We've mapped about 15,000 racial covenants in Hennepin County thus far, and we've identified many thousands more. Like I said, we're still in the process of actually translating these documents to points on the map. And we've learned that these covenants are both pervasive and explicitly racist. To kind of add to the theme of uncomfortable language, I have another one, a covenant from Lake Minnetonka area that reads that no persons of any race other than the Aryan race shall use or occupy any building or lot, except that this covenant shall not prevent occupancy by domestic servants of a different race domiciled with an owner or tenant. And this particular restriction was from 1946, I should like to point out, after World War II. So who's targeted with these restrictions? They're incredibly, incredibly explicit. And what we've learned so far, let's see if this thing will pull up. Oh. So these are the racial restrictions we've identified thus far in Hennepin County. This is a time-enabled map. If you look at the bottom corner there, it's 1924, 1925. So it's showing the spread of these restrictions over time. Each one of these blue dots on the map canvas is an individual property that was exclusively reserved for the use of white folks. In this case, white folks of the so-called Aryan race. And as I mentioned, we've already mapped over 15,000. You're going to see a lot of blue on this map. If anything, this is grossly underestimating the total amount of restricted property in Hennepin County. As I mentioned earlier, we have many thousands more of these covenants we have not been able to map yet. Let's see if I can get out of here. Ooh, technical difficulties.
Representative Lesh.
Yeah, by all means.
Hey, how do you prove you're Aryan? Because I'm pretty sure. Did they have to was there a card they had back then, or how'd you prove you're Aryan?
There actually were multiple Supreme Court cases. I don't want to get too far afield here, but there were multiple Supreme Court cases that were dealing with precisely this, where these cases would make it to court, and they would have the legal burden of proving what race you are. And there was actually a very famous case where somebody who was from the Caucasus area, who would, look Middle Eastern, I think, to us today, but argued that he was Caucasian because linguistically, if you trace, that's the origin of the word Caucasians, from the Caucasus. And the Supreme Court effectively ruled that we know you're not white because we're white and we know you aren't. So the circular logic there, right? I mean, this is the problem, making judicial decisions based on this sort of language. But for the aside there. But covenants in Hennepin County, the first one that we found is dated from 1910. We know they were encouraged by the federal government. Federal redlining policies were based in large part on where covenants were and were not located. So local practices that were happening right here were determining how these federal lending laws were being applied. We know they are located throughout the state due to resource limitations. We started with Minneapolis. We've since expanded to Hennepin County. We haven't been able to look at the entirety of Minnesota yet. We have taken a cursory look around at some other counties in St. Louis County, Stearns County, Ramsey County. These all have covenants. Effectively, every place that we've looked, we've found these things. So I don't think it's a great stretch to say that this was a statewide practice. This was not endemic to Hennepin County. And they enforce intergenerational segregation. So how covenants work as a legal mechanism, once you get one of these things into the title record, it's there forever. I mean, this is why we're still finding these today after these properties have been transferred, dozens of times in some cases. The covenants are still attached. They're no longer legally enforceable. The Fair Housing Act in 1968 put an end to this as a legal practice. Minneapolis actually, as I just learned sitting here earlier, similar to sexual harassment, Minneapolis actually led the way, or Minnesota, pardon, Minnesota led the way on racial covenants and passed a separate state law in 1955 that made this illegal, so over a decade before the passage of the Fair Housing Act. So a common question we get, and something that I hope I can at least briefly answer today, is, you know, if these have been illegal for 50 years, why should we even care about this, right? Like, how is this relevant to the here and now? And while we're still an ongoing project, a couple of kind of points have emerged that I'd like to go over. And first is that we've learned that Minneapolis was not always racially segregated. So this idea that urban space and racial segregation have always gone hand in hand, that this is just something that kind of naturally happens, is demonstrably untrue, at least for Minneapolis. So these two maps that you're looking at now, I built these using raw census returns from 1910 and 1940. And in 1910, the area of the city with the highest percentage of black residents was about 12.5% black over near North Minneapolis. In addition to that, you have emerging African-American communities down by Lake Harriet, Lake Nokomis, sprinkled along West River Parkway, along the Mississippi, and throughout northeast Minneapolis. Just 30 years later, so 30 years after the first covenant was put into place, the picture looks radically different. By 1940, there is no census unit south of Lake Harriet containing multiple black families. There is no census unit east of the Mississippi containing multiple black families. And for the first time, we start to have majority-minority neighborhoods. So we now have 5 census districts that are between 25% and 60% African-American. So the effect that these covenants had was pretty profound, right? I mean, this created a massive kind of resorting and reordering of where folks could and could not live in the city. Here's an inset, too, just so you can see a little bit better what happened down by Lake Harriet. So 17 black families in 1920, and it zeros across the board by 1940. They'd all been pushed out by these racially restrictive covenants. We've also learned that covenants were preventative and not reactive. So these explicitly racist documents, these are not being put into place by individual white homeowners. Rather, they're being put into place by developers at the point when land is first kind of turned from farmland and into a municipal property. So this is an aerial image of South Minneapolis. It's like 60th down by Diamond Lake, if you're familiar with the area. And it was taken in 1938. Each one of those red rectangles on there, that's a covenant that existed prior to this photograph being taken. So racial covenants are being embedded into the landscape before the roads have even expanded to this part of the city, before houses had even been built into this part of the city. So this is really going in kind of at the ground level of municipal expansion. And we've also learned that covenants set the stage for a whole host of subsequent systems of racial discrimination, which we are very much dealing with and living with today in the here and now. This is that same 1940 census map, but I've overlaid subsequent infrastructure projects put in by the Department of Transportation that happened after this fact. And the largest black neighborhood near North Minneapolis was wiped out by 94 and through 94. Very similar story happened on the other side of the river over in the Rondo neighborhood in St. Paul. 35W also wiped out the emerging black community on the east end of downtown, same thing along Hiawatha, and same thing along 35W. We also know that today the Twin Cities has the largest racial house gap in the United States of America. The 100 largest metro areas in the country, we have the largest gap between black and white homeownership rates. It's about 3-1. 75% of white families in the Twin Cities own their homes, about 25% of black families own their homes. If you look at the gap in net wealth, it's even worse. That's over 10-1. So these historic policies, these historic practices are very much still with us today because they created this massive bifurcation in who gets to own property and who doesn't, and who gets to accumulate wealth over time and then pass that wealth on to their kids and who is unable to do that. So that's a little bit kind of the context of the history of racial covenants and what we're doing with mapping prejudice.
Representative Dabney?
So, Madam Chair, we're open for questions on the bill and on the content.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, thank you, because this fascinates the heck out of me. And I've always wondered, what motivates a person to decide they're going to write any kind of covenant, but specifically a racial covenant, into the land that they sell? There's no incentive for them to do that, is there? I mean, financial incentive.
Is this to the testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Silberg.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, developers were bragging about racial covenants. We found multiple newspaper accounts where they would print the totality of the restriction right next to all kind of the bullet point list of great place for your kids, next to lakes, good schools, here's the racial restrictions we've put into place. And the argument at the time, what folks were using in the first half of the 20th century, was that this was a way to protect your financial investment. The belief was that white space was just fundamentally more desirable and more financially stable than integrated space or African-American space. And developers were making decisions based on that assumption. They were adding these covenants as kind of a selling tool to say, hey, we've got this great new property for you, we've got this great new house for you, and we're going to ensure that your investment is protected because we've placed racial covenants on every other house in this addition. And this neighborhood will be, by law, white forever.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the answer. So would a seller of the land who sold to a developer, the developer would encourage them, based upon a selling price, and they negotiate, you write this covenant in when you sell to me, because it would be from the seller, mm-hmm. right? Or was it the developer who owned the land and then wrote the covenant in?
Mr. Erman Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative, usually the developer. So the broad kind of sketch of how this stuff works is you have, you know, Mr. John has a farm in South Minneapolis, a developer like the Seven Oaks Company, buys this farm and divides it into municipal lots. Each time they sell one of those municipal lots, that's when they add that restriction.
Okay. And last question, Madam Chair. Did these, I know that the 1920s and 30s, there was a huge trend of eugenics in the country. Nobody even talks about that anymore, unless you're a nerd and you watch old weird history shows like I did when I can't sleep. But was that in any way hand in hand? Was that like totally a separate issue? Or did it kind of feed into this whole sort of trend that was going on in conjunction with racial covenants like this?
Mr. Erman Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think they work hand in hand. The two covenants that we've read, these are two examples. Another very common one actually uses very eugenics-flavored language, and I'm quoting from the top of my head here, but I believe it prohibits members who are Chinese, Japanese, Moorish, Turkish, Negro, Mongolian, or of African blood or descent. So terms like Mongolian, for example, I mean, these are being lifted directly from the eugenics language that's taking place during this time.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair. If I may respond to Representative Lesh, if I understand my history correctly, there was a eugenics professor at the university, a Professor Dite.
Right.
There is a avenue in my district named after him.
Oh. Well, there you go.
Awesome.
Madam Chair, you know, and you're not going to change that name, right? So we always remember it. Madam Chair, this is one of those pieces that, you know, the eugenics stain, I think, on American history is one of those things that we've mostly whitewashed, pardon the pun. But when we fought Hitler and suddenly discovered that we hated the Germans, who were totally into eugenics even more than us, we suddenly discovered eugenics was really bad, so it fell out of favor. So post-war baby boomers and everyone else completely forgot about this aspect of our history. And we're still making laws in this legislature based on carryover effects from those trends in the 1920s and 30s here now. So I appreciate you bringing this forward and pointing it out to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lunin.
No, the testifier answered my question, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. Very good. Any other member questions? Representative Carlson.
Just real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've seen some of the redlining maps that the city of Minneapolis has kept historically. I'm sure you mentioned CPED that you're working with, so I was pleased to hear that. Those are city-produced maps. I believe some of I'm seeing head shakes. So those were maps. How did they come? I guess the question would be, how did the city obtain them?
Mm-hmm. To the testifier.
Yeah.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative. So the redlining maps were commissioned by HOLC, which was a subdivision of the Federal Housing Administration in the late 1930s. They contracted out with bankers, real estate agents, developers, and local cities to kind of determine which areas were considered hazardous and which areas were considered desirable. So it's kind of this like complex interplay where the federal government's sort of taking the lead, but they're actually building these maps and determining which areas are good and which areas are bad based on local input. And they built hundreds of maps like these throughout the United States of America. And these redlining maps determine who can get loans and who can't. If an area is redlined, that means the FHA will not insure your mortgage if you try to buy a home in that redlined area. And most private banks, you know, they take their lead from FHA policies. If they see the federal government saying this area is a risk, they're also going to view it as a risk, and they're not going to lend. So it was a way to kind of divest certain areas and spur and encourage investment in other areas that were deemed desirable by the FHA.
Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the purpose of those being housed at the city were being used for what purpose?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, you'd have to ask the city for
okay.
that. I'm not a representative of CFED, and I don't want to put my foot in my mouth.
I mean, I worked there, and I mean, they were historical documents at that point, but it's just curious to know that, I mean, and they kept because of the historical mm-hmm. reference,
mm-hmm.
but it does beg the question in terms of what their use was for back years ago.
Certainly.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess speaking of historical documents, I see what the intent of the bill was, is to allow a form to get that removed off the abstract. Is that not correct?
To the testifier, Representative Dabney?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howe, to discharge it, not to remove it, because, again, what we are looking for is an avenue for a owner to respond to the moral injury of this being on their property. But we don't want to remove the covenant from the abstract. For one, that's going to be expensive. For two, that's going to eliminate the historical record. The historical record is what we live with and the outcome of that, the product of that. That needs to remain in place so that we can be honest with ourselves and future generations as to how we got to today. But homeowners will still, I think, feel a sense of injury and want to respond. The language in the bill allowing them to discharge it is targeted and narrow and intended to be inexpensive, allowing them to do it.
Representative Powell?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dagny. I guess I appreciate the fact that we're not going to remove it off the abstract mm-hmm. because I think rewriting history like that, I think it's important to know what we did in the past so we don't repeat it. So thank you, Ms. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair Scott. And I would say, just like Representative Flesch, this stuff is quite fascinating, and I think, you know, when we look at stuff like this, we kind of get to see how Minnesota gets to be number one in everything, but the worst in racial disparities, how this has affected our housing disparities, our education disparities, our income disparities. Everything kind of makes sense when you look at where we've been historically and how that has the kind of segregations we had and how they've contributed to the problems we are faced with today. I also wanted to say I used to work for a council member in the area where Dyte Street is, and for so many years, I think maybe 20-some years now, my predecessor, Representative Phyllis Kahn, has been trying to get that name changed. And I remember when I started working at City Hall, I found the piles of letters that she wrote and gathered from neighbors to try to rip that awful history from our city, and hasn't been successful yet. Maybe it is there so that it is a reminder and it continues to serve as a reminder. We'll see how that conversation goes. But I wanted to thank you today for giving us an opportunity to kind of see how all of the issues that we're dealing with kind of stem from some of this history. And I had a question for the chair. I know this is an informational hearing, and I wanted to know why isn't it we're not actually fully hearing the bill and voting on it today so that it progresses.
I guess it was just we had the conversation, and it was almost deadline week, and I only promised it an informational hearing, and so that's how it was publicized, and that's why we're here at this moment.
Thank you, Chair Scott, and I hope we do get an opportunity. There's still more weeks left, and I think something like this would really be helpful. I hope we do get an opportunity to move this bill forward and have it be progress. Thank you.
Sounds good. Any other member questions? Well, thank you again for being here. Thank you for waiting. I know all of you are sitting in the front row and hearing more probably than you ever wanted to hear about sexual harassment. But we appreciate you being here, and thanks for taking up this fascinating task.
And I look forward to hearing more about this in the future. So,
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present this tonight. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Right. Representative Keel.
You were just lucky I wasn't going home tonight. It's a five-hour drive.
I'm Zerwas. Just FYI.
I'm new, but I'm not that.
Representative Keel, I will move House File 4458, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the HHS Committee. Finance. Representative Keel, to your bill. And members, just a little disclaimer here at the beginning. We're going to limit our discussion just to the areas of this bill that pertain to our committee. And so, Representative Keel, I think you're prepared to address just those issues or those areas. So with that, I will give you the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes. So I'll go through the bill by section. Section 2 deals with the nursing home admissions contract that must contain the name, address, and contact information of the current owner, manager, and if it's different from the owner, license holder of the facility, and the name and the physical mailing address of at least one natural person who is authorized to accept service of process. This was a discussion in the OLA report about how it was hard to contact people when they came to review the business. And Section 3 is within 30 days of the change of ownership, management, or license holder, the nursing home facility must provide prompt written notice to the resident or resident's legal representative of the new owner, manager, and or if different, a different owner, license holder of the facility, that also has to be available for other residents. So then in Section 4, this is the intent of this section is that every patient and resident's civil and religious liberties, including the right to independent personal decisions and knowledge of their available choices, must not be infringed or the facility, and that the facility must encourage and assist in the fullest possible exercise of these rights. The right provided under this section establishes benefits for the patient and or residents. Then we'll go to Section 8, where it modifies the Health Care Bill of Rights by including the right to confidential treatment of the patient or the resident's financial records and the right to access those records about themselves if they so choose. That was a conversation about having a hard time accessing records. Then we'll go to Section 12, where it reasserts that the commissioner can issue corrective orders and impose fines if the nursing home refuses to cooperate in providing lawfully requested information. That would now be grounds for a correction order or a fine. Correction orders are sometimes, just a listing of this is what we need you to meet, should it be something that physically they need to be changing within the facility. Then we're going to go all the way to Section 30, where it clarifies disclosures required in the housing with services contract. Remember that this isn't just nursing homes, just assisted facilities. We have housing with services. There are residents where you contract for a house residence as well as your services might be separate from the place that you're residing. This modifies the statute governing the content of contracts for housing with services establishment by requiring that the contract to contain the physical mailing address of the natural person authorized to accept the service of process, the statement that has the resident has the right to request reasonable accommodations, and the statement describing the conditions under which the housing services contract may be amended. In other words, if someone is changing services, there's an adaptation of some kind, that that the resident is informed of that change. Then we go to Section 31, which requires housing with services establishments to inform the residents and the legal representatives of the residents within a 30-day of the change of ownership, so that they're told right away. In one case, OHFC was visiting a resident, and the OLA was with them, and they went to the wrong place because the address was not. It was a business with more than one facility, but it turned out to be the wrong facility that they went to. And so we want to make sure that that is they know where to go. But not more importantly, that residents know who they're contacting to. So then Section 35 clarifies the conditions under which the assisted living residence lease can be terminated by placing a cross-reference in the statute governing assisted living. The establishment shall include the notice of termination of the lease, information about how to contact the ombudsman for long-term care. That gives them an ability to have someone else support them should they have questions about their termination. Then Section 39 expands the current law, providing additional civil penalties for deceptive acts perpetrated against senior citizens or disabled persons, to add vulnerable adults. Factors to be considered by the court in imposing a civil penalty are expanded to include whether the defendant provided or arranged for health care or services that are inferior to, substantially different than, or substantially more expensive than offered, promised, marketed, or advertised. That was quite a bit of a challenge, and that when they first came, they were promised things that eventually did not come to fruition or were not there, or all of a sudden, oh, we don't offer that. And I myself have actually personally had somebody on staff say, oh, you can, somebody will come take care of that for you. And it happened to be a cleaning service, and then later on the facility said, oh, no, you can't wait. It was going to be 2-3 weeks I could wait. And they said, no, tomorrow you have to have this done. So it was a difference between the contract and the person in charge and the staff who didn't know that that was a requirement. So we want to make sure that residents know that those are those changes. And then the last change, this is a little bit more language, but in Section 49, the data maintained by a common entry point would be private data on individuals or non-public data, as opposed to confidential or protected non-public data. The name of the reporter would remain confidential data on individuals. New provisions would allow the sharing of data with the vulnerable adult if both the Commissioner of Health and Human Services determine that sharing is needed to protect the vulnerable adult. A mandated reporter would be authorized to disclose that the individual was the reporter to support the claim of retaliation that might be made against them for making a report. Finally, a lead investigative agency is authorized to share the common entry point or investigative data and notify other affected parties, including the vulnerable adult, if it determines that there is reason to believe maltreatment has occurred, and the information will safeguard the well-being of the affected parties. The Commissioners of Health and Human Services shall annually publish on their websites the number and the type of reports of alleged maltreatment involving licensed facilities reported under this section, the number of those requiring investigation under this section, and the resolution of those investigations. On a biennial basis, the Commissioners of Health and Human Services shall jointly report the following information to the legislature and the governor. And with that, I believe is...
Mm-hmm. for a written appeal? Seeing none, I believe we have just one testifier. Okay, Ron Elwood and Schoenberg. Ron and Sean. So, Ron.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and really so sorry to extend your already incredibly long day, and we will be exceedingly brief. Tonight, speaking on behalf of the Elder Abuse Consumer Work Group, which consists of AARP, the Alzheimer's Association, the Elder Justice Center, Elder Voice Family Advocates, and Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, I want to thank Representative Keel and Representative Zerwas for bring this bill forward, and we appreciate the genuine concern that they both have about our elders. And first, let me acknowledge that House File 4458 is certainly improved from its predecessor and moving in the right direction. But with all due respect, as for the issues that are germane to this committee, House File 4458 falls woefully and unacceptably short of what we need to protect our vulnerable adults. First, the bill is missing the absolutely essential right to private consumer enforcement of the Bill of Rights. Rights without remedies are meaningless. And House File 4458 does not contain any meaningful remedies for consumers. And without a private remedy, consumers really have effectively no ability to enforce their rights under the Health Care Bill of Rights or the Home Care Bill of Rights. But for example, conspicuously absent is any protection against retaliation for complaining or for a family member advocating on behalf of a resident. Second, House File 4458 does not contain any protections for residents in assisted living facilities against deceptive marketing under the Home Care Bill of Rights. And third, and finally, to suggest that the health department or any other government agency can enforce these rights, including deceptive marketing, would be misleading because government oversight only deals with the facilities. It does not deal and provide any specific individual relief to the older and vulnerable adults whose rights were violated. It cannot be left to the industry, nor can it be left to government agencies to enforce individual rights. That tool must be provided to the older and vulnerable adult. And again, with all due respect, that tool is conspicuously and unacceptably absent from House File 4458. Thank you very much for indulging us at this late hour.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Burke. I'm with the Elder Justice Center, one of the five consumer members of the coalition. As Mr. Elwood said, we appreciate that this bill has made improvements, but it is missing critical civil legal mechanisms necessary for protecting seniors in Minnesota. One of those is termination protections and appeal rights for residents who live in assisted living. Too often in our state, residents in assisted living are forced to leave their homes arbitrarily, without good reason. Many of the organizations in our coalition have had too many cases where residents are discharged without a safe place to go, sometimes even to a homeless shelter. Nursing home residents and persons with disabilities who live in group homes, they have protections in law to prevent this. There is no reason why assisted living residents should not have those same protections. We recommend a three-pronged approach. First, we believe that residents in assisted living should be able to remain in their home unless their conduct significantly alters the terms of their service plan. This is no different than residents with disabilities who live in group homes and those in nursing homes who can remain there unless their circumstances change significantly. There is no reason why assisted living residents should be treated differently. Second, we believe that if a provider thinks that they must discharge a resident, then that resident has a right to appeal to an administrative law judge. This appeal right is critical. It's the same right that those in nursing homes have and similar to those in group homes. Again, no reason why those in assisted living should not have the same protections. And finally, we believe that providers should help a resident with a discharge plan so they have a safe landing if a discharge is necessary. Again, those in nursing homes have this protection, and those in group homes have this protection, and there's no reason why those in assisted living shouldn't have the same. This reasonable and straightforward set of measures would provide a critical layer of protection, bringing peace of mind to thousands of individuals and their loved ones who are counting on stability in their later years. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Keel?
I'd kind of like to respond to some of the allegations that they're not in this bill. First of all, there are protections for unfair discharges. There's laws already existing, as they indicated, in nursing homes. But that is true of many other situations where someone's discharged. I do know, in fact, unless the resident themselves refuses the help, that often there is requirements to inform them and direct them to where they can go or what their options are. But in this bill, specifically sections 15, 23, 33, 35, and 36 prescribe the very specific conditions under which service plans and leases can be terminated and require the provider to assist in transitioning the patient to the next stage of care. Then no protections for deceptive marketing. Section 11 clearly defines deceptive practices. Section 39 expands current law to provide additional civil penalties for deceptive acts perpetrated against a senior citizen or disabled persons to add vulnerable adults up to $10,000 per act if there was deceptive marketing. Then no protections against retaliation was one of the accusations. Section 9 and 51 clearly state that the retaliation for exercising rights as put forth in the Health Care Bill of Rights is prohibited. Section 12 ensures that Commissioner of Health can issue correction orders and impose fines if the commissioner finds that the violations which create a risk to residents' care, safety, or rights. And finally, it was suggested there's no ability to enforce consumer rights and protections. There are 10 instances in the bill where we affirm and expand patient rights. This bill will stop abuse before it starts. Section 50 puts teeth into the abuse prevention plan requirements by giving the Commissioner of Health authority to issue a correction order and impose an immediate fine upon finding that the facility has failed to comply. When the violations do occur, sections 12, 16, and 17 allow the commissioner to fine providers, and section 13 and 20 force providers to create a corrective action plan and be held accountable to it by the commissioner when in violation, who again can issue fines of noncompliance.
Thank you. As they were reading those things off, I'm like, I know I read that. No, it's in here.
So it has changed. It has changed. So I, yeah.
Right. Representative Howell, did you have a question? No? Okay. Anyone have a question? Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you for sticking around and presenting this bill. I just wanted to ask, I know there was a particular task force that the governor put together to look at this very complicated issue that so many of us care about. I just wanted to know if this particular bill came from the recommendations that came out of that task force. And if not, in the totality, if there were some things within the task force that were adopted in this bill.
Representative Keel.
Madam Chair, representatives, yes. There is. We combined some. We took some of, I'm looking for it now. We took some of Representative Olson's bill that was offered earlier. I am looking and I'm, I know we combined quite a bit of the suggestions. Maybe that's in the other bill too. There's a bill in public safety also, the criminal part of it. And there is a maybe you didn't mean this, but a working group that is still involved in ongoing, because there needs to be a license developed for housing with services, assisted living type direction. The OLA recommended that we do that not just for the Office of Health Facility Complaints, but also for the housing with services themselves, the assisted livings, to give some clear-cut lines for not just the providers, but people looking for residences. Having dealt with a lot of different family members and their issues, I think sometimes we like that pretty apartment when a loved one is clearly has Alzheimer's, and that's just too much for them sometimes. And I think we need to really have a larger conversation about what the recommendations and the guidelines need to be as family is looking. Because often you're not doing this on a long term, we need to get around to this and move a family member. It's usually because some health issue has happened fast and you're now making a decision very quickly. And we need to make sure, that's why the deceptive marketing, that was one of the issues I believe the governor recommended. I read so many bills now, I'm having a hard time remembering which one said which.
It's also late at night, so.
Yes, it is. It's been a long day. But more importantly, to remember that we asked the OLA to review this. They took a lot longer than we expected because it was as complicated as it was. We were supposed to hear from them the first part of January. It wasn't until the first week in March that we heard from them. And with that, deciphering all of it, we went through the bill and made sure that we could address all of the issues that the OLA suggested. One we don't talk about here in civil law is the website. Facilities are required to report by website, and that is outdated and needs to be updated. It's a 90s area. And then they were handling everything by paper. So.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I see Ron. I just wanted to see if he wanted to add something.
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ulmer, and Representative Keel, and members. The termination protections that were mentioned in this bill, it is simply a notice, which is existing law, does not deal with any appeal rights, discharge planning, or any of that nature. The deceptive practices provisions, do not apply in this bill to assisted living facilities, and B, there is no enforcement of that, so even if there is a violation for nursing home residents, there's no way to enforce that. The civil remedy provision under 325F that was mentioned, does not apply to the Home Care Bill of Rights, nor to the Health Care Bill of Rights, and that particular provision is toothless anyway because the courts in 2000 have removed the ability for anybody to take a private action. So even though there is a private right in that particular statute, the courts have barred the courthouse door for any actions. And there is no enforcement of any of the retaliation provisions. And finally, fining or providing correction orders, again, deals with the facility, does nothing for the individual to get relief, compensation, or justice for the harms done or the violations of their rights. Thank you for the opportunity to
Representative
respond.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Mr. Elwood, the things you spoke to, were those part of the recommendations that the task force put forth?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Ulmer, yes.
Okay.
Representative Ulmer, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope, Representative Teal, that as the bill moves forward, that we will consider incorporating some of that. I know that oftentimes task forces are put together. We call for commissions. We do all of this work, and then none of the recommendations are picked up, and it sort of oftentimes feels like it is one of those things that we're giving lip service to. So I hope in this particular issue where a lot of us know
what's at stake for vulnerable adults, and a lot of us have family members that most likely, and constituents that are affected by this. I hope that we consider the voices that came together to put forth recommendations that incorporate the voices of the families, the voices of the nursing homes and the assisted living industry, and the attorneys, and all of that, and make sure that we get it right the first time, and we don't have the kind of cases that have been breaking lately in the news happen again. So thank you, and I hope moving forward we get this one right. Thank you.
Representative Q, well, first of all, is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify in this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have some concerns after hearing Mr. Elwood's testimony. And first of all, Representative Keel, I don't know what Representative Zerwatt promised you to carry a bill this complicated and then make you stick around till... What time is it? Is it 10 or 11?
11 o'clock.
Till 11. So there's going to be some payback for that, probably in a big way. But in any case, despite the complexity, I have some reservations. Now, I know Mr. Elwood to be a pretty reasonable guy insofar as on a lot of the stuff, the bills that I work on with him, he wants to compromise and find a solution, work out a deal, and I don't. I want to fight with you guys, and you know. Okay, so when I hear him testifying, say, "Hold on, hold the phone here." You know, this doesn't address any of the issues. My antenna goes up a lot. So, and when he's talking about, and when he's refuting, no, this doesn't address anything, or the issues that were brought up, there seem to be a lot of holes in this. So, I don't know. Here we are after deadlines. This is going through because it's what, running concurrently with HHS, right? That's why we have it. So, those are concerns of mine, and I really hope that you'll continue to work together on it.
Any other comments? Oh, Representative Carlson, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems to me that this would be, this bill, that the way it's currently written would be, it's almost as if the assisted living community wrote it themselves. I mean, it's extremely toothless, and it seems like, we just had the assisted living industry write this bill without really taking into account the governor's task force on vulnerable adults recommendations at all. So I share my colleagues' concerns. Quick question for Mr. Elwood, since you're so close. Is there any, and this is just picking up for further clarification on Representative Omar's question, is there anything from the governor's task force in this bill?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, what has improved, when I mentioned earlier that the bill has improved since the last time, what has improved were some of the particulars that were in the governor's task force work group recommendations. The problem is that any of the enforcement mechanisms that are germane to this committee are just absent. So it's kind of a lot of they're good words, but they don't they're not meaningful unless we add the additions that are absent.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel, for bringing the bill. And I really appreciate the conversation circling on the governor's task force. I think it's important to consider those things. And just a food for thought, whenever we develop task force working groups, I've worked on a property tax bill, a lot of it based on the 2012 working group property tax report.
And in that report, it said, you know, these are recommendations for the legislature to consider because we are the ones that are actually making the laws and considering all of the things that our constituents need us to consider. And so the working groups are wonderful and great, but when it comes to actually writing the laws, that is our job and our purview. So we should consider them, yes, but whether or not every single thing from a working group or task force is in a bill, I don't think should cause us that much heartburn. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no one in the audience wishing to testify, Representative Keel, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I encourage you to read this over again. I think we have a difference of opinion. I have been told more than once that the governor's task force will get this enacted much faster. That is not true. The commissioner is cited with having to write this and get it set up. I do believe that the legislature should be responsible for getting the licensure and the rules correct, and I think that we need to have more than one group. Unfortunately, the governor's task force did not include any providers or any private individuals. I think that's a very important conversation to have. In fact, I've had a few of them contact me. The other concern I have, members, is this bill was developed by people that live in the metro area, and I'm sorry, I live very rural, and there are some very serious problems with the governor's bill with in regards to rural assisted livings and housing with services. There's some real challenges in rural Minnesota. There isn't options for people. I have personally a problem with termination in a long-term area. If you have somebody who is sick, and this is serious, this is so serious, when somebody has a real problem and they're living in assisted living, let's say they've gone to the hospital because of a health care problem, the family along with that person and or the facility need to recognize whether or not that person should come back to an assisted living or housing with services. It may not be safe for them. The facility has a hard time, especially in rural Minnesota, being able to hire somebody to fill those needs. And so the facility may just have to say, you know what, I'm sorry, we would like to have your family member here. We just cannot. Sometimes that may be retaliation. That's what is being said. Sometimes it's a reality. I can't take care of you decently in this place, or even safely, more importantly, safely. We want to make sure that when you have a vulnerable adult has a problem, that they have the assurance that they are taken care of. And I want you to all consider that. This is just multiple problems, very challenging, and it's very challenging as a family member to have the realization that your family member can no longer live in a more independent situation, that they really do need to be taken care of in a safer place for them. And I think this is an ongoing conversation. It's going to take us a while, but I think we need to get some of these things in place right away, because we do need to make sure our facilities are taking care of people. But more importantly, and I didn't introduce this bill this way because I went through the civil law, remember, folks, this is everybody from 18 on up. This is not just elderly. We keep traveling toward elderly because we've seen the videos. We've seen all the sad things. But this is happening to disabled, handicapped. There's challenges in different areas, group homes. Things are happening with residents on residents. There's all kinds of different situations that are happening, and we need to look at that when we're doing this. There is some language in the governor's bill, if I understood the hospitals correctly, that if we enforce that, the hospitals will have a hard time serving vulnerable adults. And, oh, by the way, if you go to the hospital, I didn't realize this, and you have a procedure, a same-day thing, you are also a vulnerable adult. So you might be walking and talking, but you still are under their care. And so we need to make sure that we do not affect those laws so they can't do their job. And this all is intertwined. So I thank you, members. I know you're all tired, and it's time to go.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I know it is a complicated area of law, or area of people's health care is always complicated, and that's not an area that we delve into often in this committee. So I appreciate your explaining that, some of those situations to us in plain terms that we can relate to Representative Keel. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4458 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Keel. And,